Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, and she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
And right now we're talking about a new scientific tool that could disrupt the fundamental nature of every kind of life on Earth.
Your body contains 37.2 trillion cells, and within each is a copy of a code consisting of more than 20,000 genes and billions of strands of DNA. This code is your genome, and it determines everything that makes you, you. What if you could modify that code, bring back extinct species, eliminate hereditary diseases? That is precisely what molecular engineers and geneticists around the world are working on. George Church is one of many using a revolutionary gene editing technique called CRISPR-Cas9, which allows you to modify DNA sequences.
Paint this picture of what the future looks like as a result of CRISPR in your eyes.
I suppose the wildest description would be that you have some 150-year-old people that look like they're 20-year-old riding on a mammoth. Is that wild enough?
Well, the idea of a youthful senior citizen riding on a woolly mammoth, as you just heard there on CNN, may still be far from reality. But the prospect of editing genes, the building blocks of all life on Earth, has got a boost from a new technology called CRISPR-Cas9, or CRISPR for short. The advance is a disruptor, with excitement building around the endless possibilities it can create, from curing genetic diseases to creating crops better adapted to climate change, or even developing more humanoid pigs whose organs can be transplanted into humans. Along with a promise, CRISPR is also causing concern. The technology could allow us to change human DNA, not just in an individual, but in all of their future children and grandchildren. That's raised the question of whether we as a species are prepared for such an awesome responsibility. And among those saying we need to better understand all the potential implications of CRISPR is one of the scientists who worked on its discovery. Jennifer Doudna is a professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California, Berkeley. She is the co-author of a book called A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. Jennifer Doudna is in Berkeley, California. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
As one of the people involved in discovering CRISPR, how do you feel when you hear the excitement in the voice of someone like Jacqueline Skinner?
Wow. I mean, I just feel so honored to be part of that revolution in technology, and the opportunity to help people is really why we do the science we do.
Well, we heard a bit of an explanation from CNN there in that clip at the top, but how would you explain to a layperson what CRISPR technology is?
You can think about DNA in our bodies being the code of life that really controls who we are and what we do and our health and disease states. And having a technology that allows changes to be made to that code, and not randomly, but very precisely at desired places in the DNA that could, in principle, correct mutations that cause disease. I think that's really what CRISPR is all about.
So it allows you to edit little bits of the DNA?
That's right. It literally is a programmable tool. It allows scientists to tell this tool where to go in the DNA, where to make changes, and then introduce either disruptions to the DNA or, in some cases, actually replacing DNA sequences with sequences that are desired, for example, to correct a disease-causing mutation.
You tell a story about an entrepreneur you call Christina who met with one of your colleagues. What happened?
Yeah, so this was an interesting meeting with someone who was interested in using the CRISPR technology in humans. And in fact, she had the idea of having herself the first what she called CRISPR baby, you know, the idea that you could actually use gene editing in human embryos to create human beings that would have desired genetic traits.
And what happened?
Well, it was a very strange conversation, as you can imagine, for me, because it was clear in that conversation that she was serious about this. And even though I knew that, you know, this would not be possible today for many reasons, both regulatory but also technical, it was a bit alarming to know that she might think this way and that that might be the way that others would think, too, about opportunities to perhaps make money or garner attention by doing something very radical like that.
This is why you want to not only talk about the science, but the ethics. You want us all to be having these bigger discussions, huh? To really think about this.
I think it's hugely important. And I think it's also a wonderful opportunity to get people involved in discussing a really exciting proverbial moment, in a way, in science, you know, something where we're seeing this transformative change in what we can do with genetics. And so this is a great moment to invite people to learn about this, understand it enough that they can engage in a meaningful discussion.
Hmm. Some people have talked about bringing back the woolly mammoth. We heard that clip off the top. Even creating a winged dragon with CRISPR. Is that possible?
Well, there's possible and possible. possible or probable, maybe, is the way to put it. I think, you know, the thing about gene editing is that it opens the door to doing things that have never been done before. So people have talked about, for example, the idea of creating a unicorn, you know, so putting genes to make a single centered horn into a horse. Is that possible? I think, in principle, the answer now is yes. And, you know, could it happen immediately? No, for various technical reasons. But I think this is one of the reasons people are so captivated by it, is that it just really does open the door to things that we've never been able to even really contemplate before.
Well, let's talk about using CRISPR on humans. What is the promise of CRISPR when it comes to disease?
Well, I think, you know, it's fantastically exciting to think about a technology that allows correction, you know, of DNA sequences that would otherwise cause terrible disease. And I hear from people that have genetic disease in their family virtually every day who are, you know, very excited about the potential for this to really have an impact on their health in the future. I think that's, you know, clearly is tremendously exciting.
And how close are we to actual treatments or cures through that, then?
Well, I think it's important to appreciate a couple of things. First of all, the technology is clearly very powerful, as we've heard. However, it does require introduction into cells to work. And so I think one of the big challenges ahead for using this in people is being able to deliver the gene editing molecules into cells or tissues in a person. And this is why I think, and I think many people would agree, that, you know, one of the most likely first targets, clinical targets for gene editing is going to be blood diseases, for example, sickle cell disease. These are diseases where we understand the genetics. There's a single gene that needs to be fixed or repaired. And we can get access to blood cells by taking them out of a patient, doing the editing, and then putting them back into the body. And so you can imagine a path, a clinical path forward, faster than for something like Huntington's, where, you know, you would actually have to think about how to introduce gene editing molecules into the brain.
Hmm. It's quite extraordinary, though. As I listen
it
to
is.
You. Yeah. And so I just want to ask, there's different kinds of gene editing. There's germline and there's somatic. What's the difference?
Yeah, very important to know, to understand that. So somatic means editing in cells that are already fully developed. They're already a liver cell or a skin cell or a blood cell, and there's no possibility of transmitting the changes that are made to those cells to future generations. The difference between that and germline editing is that in the germline, we're talking about making changes to sperm or eggs or early embryos. These would be genetic changes that could be transmitted to future generations. And so it's a, you know, when we talk in the book about the power to change human evolution, that's really ultimately what could happen if there was widespread editing of the human germline.
Do you think we should be doing germline or heritable gene editing on humans right now?
I would say no. You know, I think that this is a technology that, you know, is still in its infancy in many ways. We're learning about it. I think the opportunity to use the gene editing tool to understand better human development, I think that's exciting. But I would caution against using it clinically any time in the near future, because we need to understand it better. And maybe even more importantly, we need to have time to discuss it as a society. What are the implications of that kind of use?
In many parts of the world, including Canada, it is currently illegal to do any human germline editing, including on embryos that will not be grown into babies. But some ethicists think that's a mistake. And that includes Chris Gingell. He's a research fellow at the Uhiro Center for Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford. Listen to him.
Well, look, we miss out on an important resource, a resource that we can use to do a lot of good. If we stop now because of irrational fears about what might happen in the future of technology, we really miss out on a good opportunity to learn more about human development and an opportunity to develop a way to treat genetic disease. We alter the human germline all the time. Every time we have children the natural way, we introduce random genetic mutations into our germline. So it's not a question of whether we should change the germline. We're doing this all the time already. The question is, how do we change the germline for good? How do we do the most good with this technology? And I think this technology could be key to reducing suffering and to increasing human flourishing.
So Jennifer Doudna, how do you respond to that idea that we have a moral imperative to go ahead with germline editing research?
Well, I remember the very first meeting that I convened in the Napa Valley. This was already a couple of years ago, to discuss the question of human germline editing with a small group of scientists. And at one point, somebody leaned out across the table and said, you know, there may come a time when we would consider it unethical not to edit the human germline. And that sort of made everybody take a breath and say, well, yeah, that's a different way to, you know, think about it. In my own view, I think that clearly, you know, I mean, I think I agree with what was just said. You know, clearly this is a really exciting technology, and we have an opportunity right now to use it to really help people and also to really understand better our own biology. And I think, you know, hand in hand with that goes a huge responsibility to use this in a fashion that, you know, in the end does lead to benefits to human beings and also brings the community of people around the world along with the scientists, you know, that scientists are not rushing ahead, but that we're actually engaging with our neighbors, our parents, our kids, our friends, and so that people understand what's happening. And we avoid sort of the feeling of being, you know, railroaded or just, you know, sort of not included in a technology this important. I think that would be a mistake.
All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
Next Monday marks the 50th anniversary of Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court decision that overturned the laws that remained in 16 states prohibiting interracial marriage. The plaintiffs were Richard and Mildred Loving. He was white. She was black. They couldn't legally marry in their home state, Virginia, so they went to Washington, D.C., where it was legal, and then returned home, where they were soon arrested. Here's Mildred Loving in a 1967 report on ABC News, describing what happened in 1958 on the night the sheriff came to arrest the Lovings in their home while they were sleeping.
The night we were arrested, I guess it was about 2 a.m., and I saw this light, you know, and I woke up and it was the policeman standing beside the bed, and he told us to get up, that we was under arrest. And anyway, they carried us to Bowling Green and locked us up. And in January, they had the trial. And they told us to leave the state for 25 years.
The Virginia courts upheld the law banning interracial marriage, but the Supreme Court decision striking it down was unanimous. Chief Justice Earl Warren's written decision described Virginia's ban as designed to maintain white supremacy. My guest, Cheryl Cashin, is the author of the new book, Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. She's a professor of constitutional law and race and American law at Georgetown University. She clerked for Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. She says she wrote the book from a personal perspective as the daughter of civil rights activists and a descendant of slaves and slaveholders. We'll talk about how her parents' activism affected her childhood a little later. First, we'll talk about the Loving decision, which overturned what were known as anti-miscegenation laws. Cheryl Cashin, welcome to Fresh Air. So you tell the story behind the word miscegenation, a story I never knew before. Do you want to explain how the word miscegenation was created and for what reason?
It was created as a political hoax. You know, dog whistling about race mixing has been going on since the time of Jefferson. You know, when Jefferson was running for office, you know, people dog whistled about the fact that he, you know, allegedly, and now it's proven, you know, had a relationship with Sally Hemings. But this fear of amalgamation, that was the term of art before 1864, the fear of white people mixing with blacks, and, you know, the idea of we need a white racial purity and we need to protect it. That was part of the political machinations. And so in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, when Lincoln is debating, and this is what brings him on the national scene, one of the things that Stephen Douglas really pushed at him was he claimed that because Lincoln was anti-slavery, he was pro-amalgamation. And they're trying to scare off the working whites from supporting this new anti-slavery party, the party of Lincoln, Republicans. And then fortunately, Lincoln, who's very deft, was able to win and become the president despite that. And then when he's up for reelection, these guys come up with this political hoax. They come up with this pamphlet. They make up this name, miscegenation, putting together two Latin words, miscere, to mix, genus, race, miscegenation, and they basically put out a fake pamphlet that is supposed to be, it looks like a pro-mixing document endorsed by the Republican Party. And for about a year, some people fell for this. Lincoln, fortunately, did win despite that, and it's exposed as a hoax later.
And the booklet is called Miscegenation, the Theory of the Blending of the Races Applied to the American White Man and Negro. And you describe it as advocating the creation of a superior race through the mixing of the races, and that this was like fake stuff designed to scare people into thinking that this was actually Lincoln's agenda, that this is what
Lincoln's
he wanted
agenda,
to do,
right.
To create a superior race through the mixing.
By mixing,
races.
Right. You know, your daughter's going to end up being in bed with a Negro if you vote for Lincoln in the Republican Party.
Okay, let's get to the actual story of Richard and Mildred Loving, the couple who were the plaintiffs in the 1967 Supreme Court case. Tell us a little bit about the background of Richard and of Mildred.
First of all, they come from a little hamlet called Central Point, which had existed from colonial times. From colonial times, there were three populations in this little rural farmer's hamlet. There were Native Americans, blacks, and poor whites. And just like in colonial Virginia in the 1600s, these people were used to working together. And so Central Point had a long history of mixing. And there were a lot of mixed race people. Mildred Loving herself, her maiden name was Jeter, Mildred Jeter, came from a family that claimed mixed black and Native American Rappahannock heritage. Richard Loving was an interesting guy. He first meets Mildred because he comes to Mildred's house to hear her brothers play bluegrass music. So he liked hanging out with her brothers. He had Negro or colored friends, his two best friends. They drag race cars together. His father worked for one of the largest Negro, I'm using the term that was, the term used for black people at the time, the largest Negro landowners in the county. And so they were used to mixing despite virulent Jim Crow segregation that forced Mildred to go to very inferior colored schools and Richard went to the better resource white schools. Well, he falls in love. They fall in love. You fall in love, people have sex. She got pregnant. He did the honorable thing. He loved her and he wanted to marry her. And I think somehow he knew he couldn't marry her in Virginia because of the 1924 law. And so they go off to D.C., get married and come back to live in Virginia. And the 1924 law rendered them felons. And a very willful sheriff comes and drags them out of their bed in the middle of the night after they've been married a couple of weeks and throws them into jail. Mildred spends 5 days in jail, and that's the beginning of their 9-year journey just to live as man and wife in Virginia.
So Richard gets out on $1,000 bail, but she stays in a rat-infested jail cell for 5 days while she is several months pregnant, no less.
Right.
So the Lovings got a lawyer, and the lawyer basically told them to negotiate a plea. So they did. They negotiated a plea for a 1-year suspended sentence on the terms that they would agree to leave the state.
Right.
And they were banned from returning for 25 years.
Right.
So they moved to Mildred's cousin's house in Washington, D.C. And why do they end up going back to Virginia?
Well, these were country folks. They missed the country. They missed their rural way of life. They missed their family. They missed this community they were so tied to. I think particularly for Mildred, she found D.C. and city life miserable she didn't like that her children didn't have a place to play. And, one of her children got hit by a car, and that seemed to be the last straw. This woman was the most reluctant of agitators. I think had her son not got hit by a car, she may not have finally got the gumption to do something. But that's why. And they kept going back and getting caught.
Going back to Virginia and getting caught by
just
the police.
Just to visit, and they mm-hmm. would get caught. I think they got caught and rearrested twice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You said she was the most reluctant of agitators. Her husband was perhaps even more reluctant.
They both were. They both were. I think they found their voice, once they got lawyers, ACLU lawyers were representing them. And they started talking to reporters. I suspect, I don't have any independent information on this. I just suspect that the lawyers told them that it would help their case if they started talking to reporters. And so, there's wonderful footage of them. And you see them starting to talk, particularly Mildred, you see her starting to talk not just about what this means for her family, but what it means for other people as well.
How did they end up bringing their case to the Supreme Court? They're not people who thought in those terms. They were not activists?
No, not at all. They were quiet people who really just wanted to be left alone. And I think Richard in particular was shocked that it was going this far. He as I understand it, he kept having hope that the guy who entered the 25-year banishment would just come around and just let them come back in after a few years. But the ACLU lawyers perceived that this could be big. But by 1967, I think the court was ready to hear it, and the Supreme Court of Virginia handed them, on the lawyers in the case, on a silver platter, an opinion that it was pretty nasty in its language. I mean, it basically condoned white supremacy, and it condoned this idea of racial inferiority of people. And by 1967, particularly, you know, Chief Justice Warren at that time, he had evolved a lot from the time when he was an attorney general in California. So this, you know, it all comes to a head. And just Chief Justice Warren in the case says, you know, these laws are a relic of slavery and an instrument of white supremacy. And he says it aloud in with capital letters. And he's basically, I think, trying to steer the country toward accepting that we can't have a country based on this idea anymore. It's time to put this to bed.
So, you know, your book is called Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. And Chief Justice Earl Warren's decision in the Loving versus Virginia case actually mentions white supremacy. He writes that Virginia's ban on interracial marriage was, quote, designed to maintain white supremacy, unquote. Do you know if white supremacy was ever, like, named that way in a Supreme Court decision before or even after?
That was the first time and the signature time when the Supreme Court of the United States says explicitly, this law is about maintaining white supremacy. The first time they used these words to name what the Civil War and the 14th Amendment should have defeated, right? There are a couple of other times where a justice might have said this, but this is the Supreme Court and a unanimous opinion written by Chief Justice Earl Warren, right? And I think that is the signature victory in that case.
Monday is Loving Day, and I think we could all use a little of that. But Loving Day marks the anniversary of the United States Supreme Court decision in Loving versus Virginia that declared all laws banning interracial marriage unconstitutional. Richard Loving, who was white, and Mildred Loving, who was black and Native American, were married in 1958 in Washington, D.C. But when they returned to their home state of Virginia, they were arrested under that state's law, which criminalized interracial marriage, if you didn't know the history. At their peak, at least 41 states had similar laws designed to preserve white supremacy. By the time the Lovings were married, 16 states still had these laws on the books, 1958, making interracial love and marriage a crime until the Supreme Court declared such laws unconstitutional. You know Jamie Floyd, attorney, legal analyst here at WNYC and the local host of All Things Considered for the station. She was born and raised here in New York, has a personal connection to this story, and she joins us now to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Loving decision and a new project that she's launching on Monday here on the station on love, race, and identity in Trump's America. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Brian. And, you know, I think I wrote that part of that introduction, and I'm going to correct myself.
Okay.
And this is a mistake that's often made about the Loving decision.
Uh-huh.
So when the Lovings were married in 58, 2 years after my parents were married in 56, there were 22 laws on the books. By the time the case came down, there were 16. And in fact, when the court took the case, this is how quickly the country was changing, Bob Dylan, changing. There were 17 laws on the books when the court took the case at the beginning of 67. One of those laws was repealed in the course of that year. And by the time the case came down, 16 laws still on the books. But you are so right. 41, at least 41, by some historians count 42 of these laws on the books at the peak of their existence. Virginia's was one of the most insidious, if not the most insidious. It was called the Racial Integrity Act of 1924. And actually, the first one was passed in the 1600s. They were then repealed and then reinstated after the Revolutionary War.
And do you want to reveal your personal connection?
Sure. My parents were married in 1956, and it was at a time when 22 states had these laws. They had to travel to three different states to find a doctor who would give them the blood tests. States had different ways of enforcing the laws, and the laws varied from state to state. And by the way, although the South was the most draconian, and those 16 states that the Lovings confronted were all in the South, it was a majority of Southern states by the year 1958, let's not leave out California. Let's not leave out Arizona. Let's not leave out Texas, my mother's home state, which was one of the states enforcing these laws when my parents were married. My mother was from Texas. My father was from Indiana, which was the cradle of the Klan in the Jim Crow South. A lot of people don't know that. So they were married in 1956 and faced horrific discrimination even after they were able to find a doctor courageous enough to give them the blood test in Chicago. And they got the blood test and they were married. And they stayed married for nearly 60 years until my father's death in 2015.
Who was white? Who was black?
Now, very different from the Lovings. And that's a really significant question, Brian. My father was African American and part Native American. My mother was white. And their love story is I think, a truly hopeful sign for what America can be. But I don't think the Lovings would have prevailed had not Richard Loving been white. And many historians of race point that factor out. The Lovings were humble people. They were poor people. They grew up in a part of the South. They were childhood sweethearts and grew up in a part of the South, a rural hamlet of Virginia, where race mixing was common going back to colonial Virginia. So this was nothing unusual to them. They really just wanted to live their lives. They weren't marching on Washington, even though lots of other people were. They weren't terribly well-educated people. But they sensed that this was just wrong. They weren't seeking to change the world or the laws, but
just
in fact, they did.
Marriage and their family and their life.
They had the perfect surname.
Absolutely. Right. God, you know, that's why they chose Sally Ride to be the first woman in space.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, you could think of a million other examples. Did you suggest a minute ago that it was politically easier to get this through the Supreme Court if the man in the couple was
white? Yes, I'm not suggesting it. I am stating it. It is, and I believe still is, was and still is, easier for a white man to be in a relationship with a black woman than it is for a black man to be in a relationship with a white woman. And when we talk about interracial love, cohabitation, sex, procreation, the relationship between the black man and the white woman is the relationship feared most by white supremacy. And the Racial Integrity Act, let's be clear, that was rooted in white supremacy. It had as its purpose white supremacy. And of course, first and foremost, it forbade the marriage of any white person with someone of another race. It defined white person as someone who, quote, has no race whatsoever of any blood other than Caucasian. And as you pointed out, Brian, in the intro, you can't go to another state and then come back to Virginia and have a valid marriage.
Yeah.
And these people were lying in the bed, in the privacy of their own home, in the middle of the night, newlyweds, and the cops came storming in and arrested them and threw them into jail, and they were charged. These were felonies in most states, and in Virginia, certainly. So completely violative of the marital home, as the court pointed out in Loving versus Virginia, the right, fundamental right to marry. But I think as a political matter, the fact that Richard Loving was a white man, a humble family, this was a humble family, that these were poor people, and that they just wanted to get on with living their lives, that made this much more palatable to the court and to the American public.
And Jamie, your project that you're launching on Monday, Love, Race, and Identity in Trump's America, is really focused on the children of interracial couples, right?
Yes. I mean, we want to keep the conversation going. It's called the Other Box Project. It's a year-long exploration about what it's meant over the course of these 50 years to check that other box. So we think of the U.S. Census first and foremost, but it's not just there. It's in healthcare. When you go to the doctor and you ask your race, are you black? Are you white? Are you Native American? What we used to call American Indian, and many still do. Are you Hispanic, which is not a race? The census tells you right up front, Hispanic, not a race, but we still want to know, are you that?
Mm-hmm. Other.
Or other. We check the other box. So what does that mean in a society that has failed to fully reckon with multiracial identity? What does it mean to have racial classifications at all? Even though there are some good reasons to have them, why do we have them? And what does it mean for those of us who check more than one box? And by the way, Brian, you could only start checking more than one box on the census in the year 2000. That's a new thing. And it's the fastest growing category in American life on the census.
More than one. Check all that apply.
Check all that apply.
Rather than being lumped into other if no simple category works for you.
Exactly.
Do you like it?
Do I like it? I if people really care about me, because this project is not about me. I'm interested as a journalist, as a reporter, as the curator of this project in hearing other people's stories. But for me, I'm African-American. And one of the things we've learned in this in the run-up to this project, we started in 2014, is that it's very much a continuum of time. So if you go back to people like myself, and people are surprised when I say I'm African-American. You can go on the WMYC website right now and look at my picture, and you might say, really? But I'm African-American. I was born in 1964. Civil Rights Act passed that year, 65, the Voting Rights Act. Loving was 3 years. I wasn't legitimate in 16 states,
yeah.
Right? So those of us, Barack Obama, white mother, raised by his white grandparents, but considers himself, has said very boldly and plainly, African-American. But when you get to people born in the 70s, certainly in the 80s, and you come to the 90s and people born after the year 2000, definitions of ourselves start to change. And the reason for that, Brian, is that we didn't even have the language when I was growing up. We didn't have multiracial and biracial. We were struggling for language. Colored was a term applied to us. We didn't like it. Mixed race, okay, that kind of worked. Mulatto? No, right, no. I was called things like half-breed, mixed nigger, half-nigger. I know this is WMYC, but I know also the list of words that we have to cut for, and this isn't one of them. I was called Oreo cookie. That was a kinder word that was used for me. This was in New York City, Brian, here in Greenwich Village and on the Lower East Side. So you can imagine what was happening to kids in Virginia who were mixed race, or in Alabama or Mississippi, the places where the Racial Integrity Act, that held on in Virginia till 1979. So to find your identity, it was much easier for people born in 54, 64, even 74, to just embrace African-American identity, what we then called black or black power even.
So in framing the Other Box Project as Love, Race, and Identity in Trump's America, are you looking for people in this other category, this mixed race category, to play a certain role in our divided nation?
Yes, yes. Well, what I found in watching my parents and their 60-year love story was their ability to share with me a conversation between each other and across racial lines. And so what I've seen, especially across generations, so our project has people from ages 90 all the way down to 14 years old. And the ability of those people who grew up in families like mine to have conversations with people of all races and also all generations about race, but also class, gender identity, identity broadly speaking, in this really divisive time, I think is phenomenal. And Brian, I conceived this project when Barack Obama was still president, and I thought, wow, we have this biracial, multiracial family, this we think of him as a black president, but he is really from a biracial family. So that was what we originally conceived the project to be as he was getting ready to leave office. But now with President Trump in office and a resurgence of neo-nationalism, I think it's critically important to have these conversations.
Say, brother, can I get some of that water, man? Just a little bit, you know, maybe like a drop or two. You got all the water in the world, brother. Just let me get a little bit, please. That's all I can get. I mean, I see you over there shining with all that water, man. I just need a little bit. I mean, it's hard out here.
Genesee County officials say they are shocked and disappointed that a longtime land bank official used racial slurs when talking to an independent journalist.
The derogatory comments have led to the resignation of Phil Stair. ABC 12's Randy Conant has been following this story all day long, and he joins us now with details. Randy?
Angie, on May 26th, Stair was driving to a restaurant with Chelsea Lyon, an environmental activist and independent journalist. She began to secretly record the conversation as he vented.
Well, Flint has the same problems as Detroit.
Nigga!
They pay their bills. Believe me, I deal with them.
Stair also complained about deadbeats moving into the south side of Flint. When the conversation appeared Sunday on the Truth Against the Machine website, Stair offered his resignation, saying he was deeply sorry for what he had said and for those he had offended.
I think that it's in all of our best interests that he's moved on. It's disturbing to me. I know it's disturbing for the board of directors. It just frankly has no place in an organization that serves the public.
Wildman said if Stair hadn't resigned, she would have fired him. Protesters showed up at the Genesee County Board of Commissioners and said how shocked they were that someone with Stair's mindset was a part of the land bank.
I was extremely troubled to have a public official make those kind of statements about the residents here in this community. And not only did he say them about African American, but he said about other folks as well.
Stair was a sales manager for the land bank and had been with the organization for about 16 years. Some commissioners say it may be time for more sensitivity training for county employees.
I was very disappointed to hear the allegations against him.
Now, Lyons, who made the recording, says there are more audio files coming. She says what was released is just the first wave. Randy Cohn at ABC 12 News.
I just want to go for a swim, that's all. I ain't went for a swim since I was a little kid. You probably just be throwing it all willy-nilly, just pouring it on you. On your shoes for no reason. I need water, man.
A recent report from the Urban Institute comes to a pretty shocking conclusion. States with more black residents have less generous welfare benefits. Vermont, for instance, about 1% black, gives TANF, or temporary assistance for needy families, to 78 out of every 100 poor families. Arkansas, about 15% black, gives TANF benefits to just 7 out of every 100 poor families. Oregon, like Vermont, about 1% black, gives a single-parent family of three in poverty $506 a month. Mississippi, 60% black, gives under half of that, $170 per month. The study concludes if the poor look like the people pulling the purse strings, traditionally largely white state officials, they will get benefits. If they don't, they won't. Heather Hahn is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and one of the authors of the study. And Heather, I know you have some conclusions that are outside the question of race, but have I largely got your conclusion right when it comes to race?
Yes. So we found that state policy decisions on TANF are significantly related to race. States with large African-American populations, all else equal, have less generous and more restrictive TANF policies.
You say all things being equal, but are they? You know, is it possible that a state that gives out more money per poor family has fewer families in poverty? And since these are, you know, finite block grants from the federal government, is it possible poorer states have more demand for the benefit and so to meet that demand have to give fewer benefits?
Well, one of the factors that we looked at was the child poverty rate in the state. And we looked to see if the child poverty rate was associated with different policy choices. We also looked at whether the share of the state legislature that was Democratic or Republican had an effect on the different policy choices. And those variables had some effect on some individual policies. But when we looked across the board at the policies, the consistent pattern was that the share of the African American population was what was associated with the less generous and more restrictive TANF policies. And that's holding constant the child poverty rate and the political factors and other demographic and economic factors in the state.
And there are other differences as well in states with a larger African American population seeking help. There are often more restrictions.
Yes. So if we take a specific example of the consequences for a family that does not comply with the work requirements, for example, most states, if a recipient does not comply with the work requirements, there are what are called sanctions or consequences. And often that starts with a benefit reduction that then escalates to the closing of the case or termination of all benefits if that noncompliance continues. There are some states where the first time someone does not comply with work requirements, the initial sanction is to close the case or terminate all benefits. And what we found was that if you look at the average state, this isn't any actual state, but a state that had all the average characteristics of the nation, there was a 44% likelihood that that state would have this harsh initial sanction where all the benefits are cut off the first time someone does not comply with the work requirements. If you took a state that was the same in every respect, except that the African American share of the state population was 5 percentage points higher than average, then instead of a 44% likelihood of having that harsh initial sanction, there'd be a 54% likelihood of having that harsh initial sanction. So that's just one concrete example of how that plays out.
Well, there's other examples of differences. Oregon, again, a state with a largely white population, helps people get off welfare, tries to get them a job, pays their wages for up to 6 months when they're off welfare. Mississippi, which has a work requirement, doesn't help them get a job. So there's sort of a divide here. And 'twas always thus. We're reading a terrific piece in The Atlantic about the history of this kind of assistance. And originally it was called mother's pensions. This was the precursor to welfare, early 1900s. They mostly went to white women, widows. And in fact, caseworkers at the time denied these benefits to African-American women because they felt African-Americans should be working, and that was beneath these white widows. I mean, this is well documented.
Yes, there is a long history of racial differences in social welfare in this country. Providing welfare was a local responsibility and very subjective. And so to a large degree, welfare was available only to white widows or others who were deemed deserving or morally upright. And over time, and then especially in the 1960s, the federal government gained an increasing role in providing welfare. And with that, established objective eligibility rules that opened access to African-American families in poverty.
Yeah, but even then, it's just so fascinating. Then President Johnson, launching this war on poverty, knew that he had to go and have a picture taken with a white family, a poor white family, to launch the PR campaign, because he knew that if he did it with a poor black family, he wouldn't get traction in Congress.
That's right. So what happened is, under these objective rules, more African Americans sought and received assistance, and so they were a larger part of the welfare caseload. And that contributed to a backlash that contributed to the welfare reforms of the 1990s that gave the policy control back to the states.
Yeah, this is under the Clinton administration. So we see the control going back to the states, and you seem to be tracking that kind of, I don't know what you'd call, I mean, it feels like prejudice, plays out in how benefits are handed out.
Right. So there is a stereotype that the typical welfare recipient is African American. And that's not true. In fact, about one third of people receiving TANF cash assistance are African American. But that misperception influences how people think about who is poor and why, and shapes their thoughts about the policies that should address poverty. So those policies in some places are influenced by people's racial attitudes.
We should say there are more African Americans seeking welfare benefits relative to their number in the population.
That's right. So African Americans are disproportionately represented among welfare recipients, just as they are disproportionately represented among people living in poverty. But they are not the majority of cash assistance recipients.
Well, but this is such a vicious cycle, because that could be, that truth could be, more African Americans seeking benefits could be because they get stuck in this cycle, as opposed to the white poor who, as I mentioned, are helped out of poverty in many states.
Right. It's important to recognize, though, that the state policies themselves are race neutral. So within a state, the state policies apply to everybody equally. But what we see is that the effects of the policies are not equal.
Right. Congress is now considering block grants for other kinds of benefits. As you do this research, what's your thinking?
TANF is a cautionary tale about what block grants can mean. So based on what I see in TANF, I would predict that if we were to block grant other programs, we would see similar results, in that fewer families would receive assistance. And when we look across the nation, we would see racial disparities in the provision of that assistance.
And they're considering block grants for things like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. These are food stamps, largely for children and others. Heather Hahn, I know you had other discoveries in the Urban Institute research, a comparison between Texas and California, for instance, that doesn't have as much to do with race.
Right. So states have different philosophies and cultures about supporting low-income families, and those may or may not be connected to race at all. And so Texas, for example, is a state that I call a pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps state, where they expect people to support themselves. And it's a place where only four families received TANF cash assistance for every 100 families living in poverty recently. California is a contrast, where the state has made a commitment to serving vulnerable families, especially vulnerable children. And in California, 65 families receive TANF assistance for every 100 in poverty. So it's hard to quantify or measure those philosophies. But when states have the flexibility to set policies, as they do under block grants, state philosophies will prevail in determining what those policies are.
And this underscores what we said at the very beginning. It has nothing to do with, you know, one state maybe having more demand for welfare benefits than another, because Texas and California are pretty much, you know, big states.
Yes, with high poverty rates.
Yeah. Heather Hahn, senior fellow at the Urban Institute and co-author of the new study, Why Does Cash Welfare Depend on Where You Live? Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm not sure anymore just how it happened before. The places that I knew were sunny and blue. I can feel it deep inside, this black nigger's pride. I have no fear when I say, and I say it every day, every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
A Thornton woman turns to Denver 7 for help tonight. She says she's been harassed several times and feels like no one is helping her. Even worse, she feels trapped since management won't let her out of her lease. Our Denver 7 Sally Mamdou spoke to the woman who says the harassment has escalated to racial slurs.
The woman tells me the first time she got a racially charged note outside her door, she felt uneasy about it. But the second time she received another racially charged note like this one, she says she felt unsafe. But the apartment complex where she lives doesn't see it the same way. At first, Timber Lodge Apartments felt like a place for Allison Butler to call home.
It seemed like a nice apartment, so.
So she moved in at the end of April, but says 5 days later, her new home turned into the last place she wanted to be.
It started with people pounding on the door.
And when Allison would come to the door, no one would be there. Then Allison says twice she found racially charged notes at her door.
What does it read?
It reads on it. This is the second note.
So you got a note before?
Yeah.
What did it say?
It read, "In words don't belong."
Allison reported the notes to the Adams County Sheriff's Office, but says the deputy couldn't do much for her because there aren't surveillance cameras around. She then reported the knocking incident to the apartment security company, which told us they confronted the people and gave them a verbal warning. What the verbal warning entails, the security company wouldn't say. Then Allison went to the leasing office, hoping to break her lease.
And their response was that I could buy out of it, which means I could pay 2 months' rent to get out of the lease, even though I'm being harassed.
But what was even a more shocking response for her is when she was told nothing more can be done.
And their response every time is that they cannot control what happens in the hallways.
We've reached out to both the leasing office and the company that manages Allison's apartment and have yet to hear back. For now, Allison says she lives in constant fear and hurt.
I'm going to school to be a therapist. I truly want to do good in the world. So the fact that I could be reduced to an does hurt.
In Thornton, Sally Memdu, Denver 7.
White girl, going through my mind. Sarah Jackson and Julie too. White girl, Julie Jackson and Sharon. Help me unwind. The more I see, the more I do. Don't tell me it's a 5 o'clock.
That's right.
He don't want to know what's going on.
It's Saturday morning, and I get a text from my producer, Catherine. It's a link to a BuzzFeed commentary titled, "White Women Drive Me Crazy." The story's by Aisha Mirza, a mental health counselor from East London, whose mom was first-generation Pakistani-British, and her dad was born in Egypt. Her stepdad is white. Aisha's article recalls a moment when she stepped on a white woman's mat in a yoga class. The woman looked at her like she was offensive. And Aisha suddenly remembered all the looks she's gotten like that from white women all her life and how they made her feel. The piece went viral. Reading Aisha's commentary was a revelation for me. I realized all the times white women had looked at me like that. From the white lady playground monitor in kindergarten who used to follow me around and reprimand me as often as possible, to my first roommate after college, the blonde sorority girl who used to sing off-key as loud as possible and regarded me like I was an alien fungus. I know plenty of white women who aren't like that. Catherine's white. When she sent me the article, she texted, "Will you please never let me become this?" I didn't say anything because that wasn't the point of the commentary. I decided to talk to Aisha Mirza myself. And she said she didn't write the piece so white women would feel ashamed and change. She wrote it so brown and black people would know that other brown and black people experience the same thing with white women and feel the same way about those looks. And those feelings are valid. I'm Rupa Shenoy, and this is an Otherhood Short.
Yeah, so the essay I wrote starts in this yoga class that my friend who was visiting from London made me go to in the first place. So kind of a little nervous anyway, and accidentally kind of move towards this woman's mat and stand on it. And she just gave me this really striking look. She looked at me in this way that I kind of describe as like fear, disgust, like horror, like real horror.
And it made you realize something about how you felt when you were a kid, right?
I guess, you know, to use a popular word right now, it was triggering, you know, it like triggered all of these memories and moments in my life where I've been othered in different ways or
kind of made to feel uncomfortable, but in these really quiet ways, you know, like the looks, the smiles, or the weird hugs or the weird touches, you know, like these really quiet ways in which these dynamics are reinforced. And I felt really angry about it. And I don't feel angry that often, so I really leaned into that.
Why do you think you were angry if you'd experienced it before?
Since I've been living in New York, which is like nearly 3 years, I've made a real effort to surround myself with other people of color and other queer people of color. And there's like a kind of incredible community here. So I hadn't actually been like in a white environment like that yoga class was. And I hadn't really dealt with like a look like that for a while. And then suddenly this white woman's looking at me and I'm like, no, this must end here.
So what do you think that look means? Where is it coming from?
It could mean a lot of things. And there are a lot of different variations on that look. You know, it's very like nuanced and deep, which I think is part of the reason why it's so hard to pin down. And I think part of the reason why people were relieved that I tried in this essay, you know, because they are looks. And it's really hard to have the confidence to say, I know why you're looking at me that way. And that's, I think, why they're so sinister. I mean, I don't actually like to focus like so much on that moment, given the scope of the essay, mm-hmm. because I don't know why she was looking at me like that,
yeah.
you know, and that's not exactly the point.
To a certain extent, it's about your perception, right, of the look?
Totally, yeah, which is valid. And that's the thing, you know, like, obviously a lot of people were very happy that I wrote this piece, but then a lot of white women specifically were like, how dare you judge this woman's look? You know, you're not inside her head, you don't know what she was thinking. And that's just really not the point, because everything is racialized, and she looked at me in a way that was triggering because I realized that there have been so many of these racialized moments in my life, and some of them are much more easier to say, like, that is racism. And she might have been a germaphobe, as, like, so many white women are, like, emailing me to tell me, you know? They're like, no, 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 like, she's not racist. She just doesn't like germs. Like, don't you understand, you know? And that's kind of the gray area that I'm really interested in looking into.
Let's talk a little bit about the reaction.
It was a big reaction. A lot of people read it. I think the editor emailed me yesterday to say that there had been over 1.5 million views at this point, and that was like a lot for a personal essay, I think, on that website anyway. A lot of emails from people of color, queer people of color, just saying, I think, that they felt seen for the first time and that they felt this kind of specific experience that they've been having their whole lives. Maybe they'd never realized that it had been upsetting them in the way that it has, and to see it written down and like made tangible was really helpful. A lot of white women emailed me to thank me for it too, which was fine. I got one really great one from a white woman actually that was just like really short, and she was like, I was so mad at you when I was reading it, which is, I heard a lot about that, about how mad white women were reading it, which she said, I was so angry because I was like, how dare this person judge me on the color of my skin? And then she said, and then I finished reading it and I realized that I've never had to worry about that in my life. And I appreciated that. I appreciated, like, being taken along her thought process there. I think white women are really struggling to own the fact that they have power and privilege, right? And that they can hurt the people around them and oppress the people around them. And it's really simple in that way, you know? And, like, white women are, like, not the only people who are in that situation where they're, like, a very oppressed group of people who can also oppress others. In the same way that, like, me as a brown person, you know, I'm not black, and therefore I have this privilege. I have the privilege of being light-skinned. I have the privilege of being, like, racially ambiguous. And if I'm not careful, I can use those privileges to oppress people around me and to, like, oppress black people and to oppress dark-skinned people. And that is uncomfortable. But I think it's a discomfort that a lot of white people and a lot of white women, which is what I was writing about, are really unwilling to own and step into.
These are the 80s, man. It's the Cosby decade. America loves black people.
We have been covering the Cosby trial and providing legal analysis every day of the trial. And so here with me today, we missed yesterday because of the Comey stuff. So just kind of catch up. Here with me today is our legal analyst, Dean Johnson. Welcome back, Dean.
Hey, Brian. Nice to be here again.
All right, let's kind of take a look at what's happened so far. Yesterday, Andrea Constant, who was the alleged victim in the case, her mother testified, and she talked about calling Bill Cosby and I'll tell you what's interesting. A couple of interesting things, and apparently like a real emotional moment in court yesterday, is she talks about how she's talking to him on the phone, wanting to know what he did to her daughter. And Andrea is listening in on the other line, unbeknownst to Cosby. And then Cosby goes on to tell her mother that Andrea had an orgasm during this thing. And apparently you heard that when the mother said that, they say that everybody in the courtroom just gasped out loud. And that you heard Andrea go, I, and hang up the phone. And then she continued, you know, on with Cosby. She broke down and cried. The mother broke down and cried. A lot of tears. Apparently everybody who's testified so far has broken down in tears except for Andrea Constand. And I'm wondering, is that kind of an emotional display? How can that not affect the jury?
Yeah, everything affects the jury, and the jury's going to be told at the end of this thing that they can look at not only what people say, but how they say it, mm-hmm. and their emotional pitch towards their testimony. And apparently Constant was not all that emotional when she testified. She's obviously somebody under distress, as anybody in this situation mm-hmm. would be, but something like that. That's so spontaneous and unrehearsed and not part of a court proceeding, mm-hmm. really, in my experience, sticks in the minds of the jury. Now, which way it's going to cut, it's hard to tell because juries look at things from all sorts of different angles that you don't anticipate.
By the way, speaking of which, now, we've talked about this a couple of times with John Burris and with Jim Hammer mm-hmm. when they were here, and that is that so far, again, you know, yesterday was day four, and Camille Cosby is not in court. You guys all said that's not going to make a difference to the jury, and I've read now three or four different articles that are pointing out that she's not there and that there is concern that the jury is going to go, why is this wife not here unless she knows he's guilty?
Yeah, you know, you always have to think of a trial as a bit of a show. The optics are very important, the visuals. Scientists say that 80% of what we communicate is nonverbal. And the fact that he has a family, if any of the jury knows about that, he has a wife and four daughters, and it was even reported that his television wife, Felicia Rashad, was going to be there.
Yes, she was.
And there seems to be very little support from at least, in fact, no support from his real family, and people could read it that way. Now, we don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. it may be that Camille is ill or the daughters are otherwise occupied, but I mean, what is more important than when your father is on trial in effect for his freedom for the rest of his life?
Yeah, yeah, 79.
Yeah, and juries read into that. Let's put it this way. It would be really helpful if he had a lot of family support. We don't know that it's going to be so hurtful that he doesn't, mm-hmm. but it would be great to have them there if you're the defense team.
Now, the prosecution also read that 2005-2006 deposition that Cosby gave in the Constand case the civil suit that was filed after they decided not to, after the DA at the time decided not to press charges. And there have been excerpts from that have been published. And he mentions getting quaaludes to give women he wanted to have sex with. And some other things that they read yesterday is he talks about how there is, quote, an area somewhere between permission and rejection. And then when talking about what happened, he said, she did not stop me and I wanted to go. Now, is that damaging or is that, you know, indicative of anything? And I should go on to say, too, that in his version of the story, you know, she said he gave her three pills and said, these are herbal, they'll relax you, these are your friends. And his version, he says he gave her 1.5 Benadryl. And after taking the Benadryl, she immediately wanted to have sex with him. Now, I take Benadryl every night.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not kidding. I take Benadryl every night to go to sleep. And now that's not happened to me once.
Yeah,
I've taken Benadryl.
You know, I've got severe allergies, too, and I've taken a lot of Benadryl. I've never had that reaction. But getting serious about what is really a serious subject, I wonder about the strategic decision on the part of the prosecution to use that deposition. I don't know that it's all that helpful to them. Cosby is not going to testify, and a lot of this deposition is really self-serving. What the passage you just referred to suggests that maybe he had a good faith belief in consent. I mean, that would be his story. and we're never going to get to cross-examine him. So in effect, the prosecution is introducing what his testimony probably would be if he were going to take the stand.
So here's something that I've got a question for you about, and that is the prosecution is reading excerpts from that 2005 deposition that he gave under oath that was sealed. And he sat for the deposition under oath and said he would be truthful because the DA had made the agreement with him, not in writing, but I guess a handshake agreement that no matter what he said, he would not be prosecuted.
Right.
All right. So in this deposition, he says that he had several sexual contacts with Andrea Constant prior to this. She says, and has said in her testimony, that the only time was when he drugged and assaulted her. Now, if this deposition is supposed to be damning, and there are some things in it that are damning, especially the one excerpt everybody published and went crazy with was where he mentions that he had gotten Quaaludes in the past to get the women he wanted to sleep with. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, can a jury cherry pick, we believe this part of the deposition, but we don't believe that part of the deposition? And if he's lying, why would he lie? Because he didn't have to sit for this deposition. It was part of the deal that was made, you know, to avoid prosecution. Am I making sense?
Yeah, and it's a typical problem. I mean, you see witnesses having inconsistencies all the time. We've seen that in this trial. And there's a jury instruction that says, all right, if you find that somebody has made a false statement, either on the stand or otherwise, that's something that you can consider in determining their credibility. So if Cosby lied about one thing, that undermines his credibility.
Okay.
But the judge always cautions the jury, that's just one factor to consider. And that's one factor you consider among others. And you need to look at the evidence as a totality and see if parts of the witness's testimony are backed up by other evidence, for example, if their manner seems that they're truthful and maybe this was an honest mistake. All of those are things that the jury's wide open to consider. So, yeah, you can believe some parts of somebody's testimony and reject
disregard others.
And disregard the rest, yeah.
So it's a day or so before the defense is expected to get the case. Today they put on a drug expert to talk about what the effects are of Quaaludes. And again, he's denying it was Quaaludes, saying it was Benadryl. But I've never seen blue Benadryl. Have you?
Not that I can.
No, I've seen white Benadryl. Yeah. I've seen pink Benadryl. I've never seen blue Benadryl. No. And they're also putting on an expert on women who've been assaulted to explain why a woman would have inconsistencies and why they don't come forward.
Yeah, and that's tying the bow on the package of the case. This has been a real dance of testimony, impeachment, and rehabilitation. And the big thing you've got to do to rehabilitate both witnesses is explain that when you're sexually assaulted, especially by somebody who's rich, famous, and powerful, your brain goes into overload and says, what's happened here is inconsistent with everything I knew about this man before. Sometimes the brain just represses those memories or changes them or explains them away in some way. We see that all the time in domestic violence situations. And in this situation, which is another power relationship, where a woman would be dependent upon this man in a lot of ways and want to like the man, behavior changes. It's not the way you would expect people to behave.
Now, he has said publicly in the interview that he gave to SiriusXM that he was not going to testify, and his attorneys had previously said that he was not going to testify. But today, his lawyer is saying that nothing's off the table, and he may testify. So two questions for you, Dean. First, do you think that the prosecution has put on a strong case thus far? And in your mind, have they proven this beyond a reasonable doubt? That's number one. And number two, if he were your client, would you put him on the stand? I should make this three questions. would you put him on the stand? And third, does a jury want to hear the defendant say, I didn't do this?
Has the prosecution made a case? Yeah, they've made enough of a case so a jury could find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But, of course, that's always up to the jury. They will get to that jury, and if it's supported by sufficient evidence. I don't think it's a terrific case. Mm-hmm. It's maybe, an average case for a regular sexual assault trial, but this is not a regular sexual assault trial. The second question is really easy. Would you put this man on the stand with this state of the evidence? No, no, no. When I was in the prosecutor's office, we had a saying that our case, the prosecution's case, always gets better when the defendant takes the stand. That's true in, you know, times 10 in this case, because you've had this deposition read. There's a lot that the defense can bring out of that deposition that would be the same as Cosby's testimony. It would be essentially the defense that they put on. And when Cosby takes the stand, he's going to be under cross-examination at some point. I don't think he's going to do well. And the real danger is that Cosby will say something that will, to use the phrase that we use in court, open the door to character testimony and maybe bring in as rebuttal witnesses some of those other 60 or so women that came forward. I mean, that's the great fear you have as a defense attorney.
Now, I was reading someplace that one of the problems that the prosecution could have is if he gets on the stand and he's the charming America's dad that everybody knows and can charm the jury.
Yeah, and he probably thinks that he can do that. The toughest clients to have, and I've had clients like this, are the very wealthy, very powerful, and I hate to say it, men who are used to talking their way out of everything and charming their way out of everything. And it's really, really hard to convince those guys to keep their mouth shut and that things will be better if they just don't say anything. And I think Cosby's one of those. It may be very hard to keep him off the stand because he thinks that Dr. Huxtable can get up there under oath and just charm the pants off the jury.
Was there a pun there?
You know, I heard it when I said it.
Okay.
As I was saying it.
I'm looking at you going, did you mean to say
that? I want to be a cop.
Shocking video out of Jersey City. A police chase ended in a crash and a fire. An innocent man caught fire, but it's what police did allegedly while he was on the ground that has officials calling some of them for their firing. Jay New York's Catherine Craig's in Jersey City right now with this controversial video and Kat, the aftermath as well.
And Michael, absolutely. The innocent man, first of all, he will undergo surgery a little bit later today. The video that he's in, it appears that officers are kicking him. And we want to warn our viewers, it is extremely graphic. First of all, that fiery crash happened right over here where that truck is passing by, right by that utility pole. Police had been pursuing one man who crashed into another, and that innocent victim was on his way to work. We want to take a look at the video. You see the victim on fire. He is 28-year-old Miguel Feliz, desperately trying to extinguish the flames on his clothing. Officers approach, and with guns drawn in the video, it appears that they begin kicking him. At least seven officers were there. This happened Sunday night. Police pursued a different man who, according to city officials, was suspected of being involved in a shooting. Officers opened fire on that suspect during the chase. He ended up crashing into Feliz on Tunnelly Avenue near North Street, and both cars were erupted in flames. A witness described to us what he saw.
They didn't help him. They just started kicking and grabbing him with the legs. And I don't think they treated him the right way. And that's not how you treat any human being in this world.
And a different take from the police union, releasing a statement in part saying, as it should be, this entire incident is being fully investigated. Taking swift action isn't always elegant, but this video clearly shows the officers acted quickly to extinguish the flames and pull this man out of harm's way. The Jersey City mayor also releasing his own statement. We interviewed him as well, Michael. He is calling for the officers involved to be fired. Also, possibly, Michael, to face criminal charges.
Context of white support. Supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 10th, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, views, if you have commentary from the news clips we just heard. Feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564 #243#. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to listeners, remind folks we are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us 8+ years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Thanks to the folks who've got things from our wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. I told folks I have been in the same house with a, at first it was a pregnant black mom. Now it is a first time black mom with a young toddler, or not toddler, young infant. And I put baby wipes on there just because seeing the volume of baby wipes that having a infant go through like is stunning, but I put baby wipes on there for her specifically, and nearly as soon as I put them on the list, they arrived at the door. I was stunned, but thanks to all the folks who have supported us, it has been grand, and she sends her thanks as well. Moving forward, some of the things I wanted to touch on before we get to the callers. Last week, at the end of the program, I said, oh yeah, by the way, listeners, you all can contribute for the compensatory call-in. I meant to say that at the beginning, before we got to the callers, to really encourage folks to do that. I would really like to see what the sound clips sound like when it is exclusively listeners making the selections. We did have a number of listeners, and generally do have listeners contribute different articles and news reports over the week, podcasts even, a lot of great information, but I didn't get to emphasize it as much as I would have liked, so that it can be exclusively listeners, and make sure that I get a high volume of audio. And I did not make sure to give adequate description. When I do news clips for the compensatory call-in, I only select news clips for the past week. So everything that you just heard, these are things that were reported from Sunday, or between Sunday, June 4th, and today, Saturday, June 10th. Everything that you just heard. And the reason that I make it exclusively for just the past 7 days is because the system of racism, white supremacy is by far the dominant force in terms of motivating people, motivating individuals classified as white. Why they get out of bed in the morning, what their life is supposed to be about, is maintaining white power over everyone they say is not white, and in particular, terrorizing black people as they maintain global white power. Now, with that being the case, that is explicitly talked about in a variety of ways in the news on a regular basis. I don't have to go back through the catacombs and dig out things that happened 200 years ago, 300 years ago. If you remember from last week, there was a news clip. It was talking about a black female professor. She canceled her visit. She was going to come to Washington State to do a lecture. She canceled it because she was terrorized so much by racist race soldiers, whites. And they said at the beginning that there have been, you know, centuries of racist laws and customs put in place that are responsible for oppression of non-white people. And that is bogus, and white people know that. That is deliberate deception, in my view. There are things that racists like Jane Elliott and Timothy Wise and Randy Blazak and William Willimon and the numerous other whites, admitted racists and the rest of them, there are things that they have done in the last 7 days, last 5 minutes, that we can focus on. And I think that is important. So for people that are making contributions for the compensatory call-in, news clips for the last 7 days. So we'll try it again for next week. So that would mean news clips, things that happen between Sunday, June 11th, and Saturday, June 17th. So if listeners, if you can send in, and it's got to be something with audio. If it's a video, no problem. If you can, if it's a video and you're able to make that an audio clip yourself, now that is a plus. But if you don't know how to do that or you don't have time, whatever, if you just find the video of the news clip that happened between Sunday, June 11th and Saturday, June 17th, drop it to my email untiljustice@gmail.com. And we'll set it up for the news clips for next weekend's compensatory call-in. With that, this week's segment was kind of a mashup of some of the clips that listeners submitted, some of the clips that I picked out, a little bit of both. Next week, I will not pick anything. It'll be exclusively listeners. I had, which is the case for most weeks, even just restricting to the past 7 days, I generally have an abundance of clips. There was a clip on prison abuse in North Carolina. It's about a 10-minute clip that I did not include. And this clip, very important. I was even questioning myself as I thought about this, like, wow, did I not include? They were talking about how the guards in North Carolina, how they would put hot sauce on the inmates' genitals, and not just any old hot sauce. They would put hot sauce that was so intense that the guards would wear surgical gloves. And they didn't say just any type of gloves. They said explicitly surgical gloves when they handled this hot sauce to place on these inmates' genitals. I don't, or I do know why. There was a logic as to why I did not include that clip this week, but I did think it was hugely important. And that's the case most weeks. As I said, you can't play everything. I generally find way more things than I can play, but that was one that did not make it for a variety of reasons, even though I am kind of questioning, man, I maybe should have played that one. Anyway, when I heard that, even though I didn't play it, Delectable Negro. Actually, that wasn't even the first thing that I thought of. The first thing that I thought of is something I've said on the broadcast for years. I've heard this before. There was a previous incident of race soldiers, inmates, putting hot sauce on black males' genitals. Wellsing moment for sure. But I've heard this before. This is not even a one-time thing. This, you know, must be a regular thing. And then I thought, Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard. Woo! Man, if you did not tune in to the book study session for Vincent Woodard, you might have missed a book that should maybe be in Gus T's top 10. Now, there were a lot of points in the book that I did not agree with. We tussled about that book for a variety of reasons. But wow, there are a lot of concepts, very important concepts, that book illustrates. And that is one. That is one of the main premises, that racists have a fetish and literally devouring, consuming melanated flesh, black bodies. And you can see this for centuries. That is the main theme of the book. And putting hot sauce on a black male's genitals? Didn't include that one. I looked back at the things that did get included somehow that were responsible for that being left out. I think that CRISPR bit is really, really, really important. Jennifer Doudna, that's the type of thing that I think does not get enough attention. So I definitely wanted to include that. All that stuff about the Lovings, I thought it was important just because it's getting so much attention for this anniversary weekend that's coming up, I guess, this Monday. And what they did not mention in the two clips that made reference, they did not mention the age disparity between the Lovings. That I also thought was extremely important. The racial terrorism, I thought, the welfare disparity, I also thought was extremely important. When we talk about economics, that's something that I've said applies on a local, national, and global level. As the percentage of black people goes up, public amenities goes way down. White people become much less interested in taking care of the roads or having great public transportation or libraries, public schools, anything. It's all welfare, so you can throw it all in the trash. Once it looks like there's one too many niggers that might be benefiting from these goodies. But I thought that was an extremely important report. Might even make an effort to get her on the broadcast. The white, in fact, I will stop there. The white women drive me crazy report was interesting for a variety of reasons, but we'll leave it there. I'm not going to have an avalanche of commentary about the Loving situation or Area 8. That's one of the most popular areas of discussion. I'm probably only going to take about four comments. So if you think that's something that you want to talk about, you should make sure that you speak up real early, because I know that sort of thing can just dominate the whole discussion. I think that was demonstrated last week, and even why we have a rule about not talking about Area 8. But I feel like, you know, since I did play two clips dealing with the subject matter, that, you know, I can allow four comments max. That's it. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you know you're in a noisy environment, music or other people talking, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. Just helps preserve the quality of the broadcast. You can unmute, you know, say whatever you need to say, and then mute yourself again. That would be super appreciated. And exclusively for the compensatory call-in, I request, if we could not use metaphors, it's been my experience, racists, they regularly will use metaphors, analogies. They will make comparisons between two separate entities that are not equivalent. They will do this regularly, and it is a clever way of practicing deception. They do this deliberately, often. Victims of racism, non-white people, we have been exposed to a lot of racists' habits, and a lot of us, we're still learning, Gus T. Renegade included. Frequently, we're trying to come to a conclusion, trying to formulate our thoughts. We will employ a metaphor and hope that that accurately conveys our view. Most often, it causes a lot of confusion, and it does not accurately state your view or your perspective. Just if we could make an effort to be as explicit, direct, clear about what it is we are trying to say, that would be extremely helpful, extremely appreciated. I'll prompt about that, and I make an effort myself to be mindful of not using metaphors. That said, and the last clip that was played about the officers in New Jersey assaulting, terrorizing a citizen that was on fire, apparently, after this, you know, collision and everything. I think one of our listeners might even have additional details about that situation. We shall see, but we'll go ahead and get to the phone lines. First few folks who dialed in with the hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Heard at least two people.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
First time calling to this show, was introduced to this show about 2 weeks ago. I just wanted to admit that I am a, I guess for lack of a better term, a reformed victim. I guess in the Get Out movie, they would call it In the Sunken Place. And it has been a large reawakening, to say the least. I feel as if I've woken up in the Matrix. So I just wanted to call in and say thank you for this. And that was pretty much it.
Oh, right on. First time caller. Glad you could dial in. Glad to hear from you, sir. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mahan DC. I wanted to talk about the first clip that I heard about genetic manipulation. A lot of that is in order to keep the people we're calling white people, the ICE albinos, is to keep them alive longer, or to keep them on this earth as albinos for a longer period of time. However, it will not work. It's not possible to remain a group of albinos for an extended period of time on this earth. You can do it for some time, but you can't do it for, at a certain time, you will go extinct as a white person, perceptually, you know. Their genetics will continue on within people with melanin, but you cannot continue on this earth as an albino in large numbers. And what I was wanting to say is another reason I don't call these people white people, like I said before, white is meaning God. And in Kiswahili, the word for God and the word for white is one letter difference. The word for God is M-U-N-G-U. The word for white, referring to a white person, or an ice albino, or a European, is M-Z-U-N-G-U. It's the same word. It's just one letter difference. So they've been able to colonize all the languages also. But I had three questions, if anybody cared to answer. If not, I'd appreciate it. And I've asked it before, the question. I've asked it to a white person, but the question is, when white people are inevitably extinct and permanently extinct, could there still possibly be white supremacy? That's my first question. The second question I had is, what is the time frame that scientists predict that white people will go extinct? Or what is the time frame that you predict that white people will go extinct? And then the last question is should black people help white people go extinct in the shortest time period, in the shortest time frame possible? Those are my questions. If anybody cares to answer, you know, I'm interested to know if black people are, you know, even considering white people going extinct. Okay, thank you.
Is it okay if I answer maybe the first?
Do we have people who have not spoken at all? I want to try and make sure we get everybody at least get one turn, and then if other folks want to add additional thoughts, we can do that after everybody's spoken at least once. Other people that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, your line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners. Well, I just wanted to chime in on you played Mr. Fuller prior to the program starting, and what stood out to me, Mr. Fuller was talking about how when white people get sick of us, they show us with mass force and just things that they do to demonstrate how serious they are about white supremacy. And it just made me think about, at that moment when I was listening to that clip that you played, what it would be like when black people got, or non-white people got, tired of being under the system of white supremacy. What I am just seeing in my day-to-day comings and goings, and even with me, you know, when you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, you really do something about certain things. And I'm just interested in seeing that day, whenever that day is, when we're really tired of being held under this oppression, mistreated, subjugated, and just dominated by white people, what that would look like. Because white people have no problem showing up. When they're serious, they use all force, and all white people come together on that one accord. So that clip that you played prior to the show getting started really stuck out to me. And I don't know, I just wanted to share that, you know, what that day would look like when black people get sick and tired of being sick and tired of racism, white supremacy. And I will mute my line.
other folks that we have not heard from at all who have a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, callers, listeners. This is The Voice from Florida. I found it interesting, the clip where she was talking about, she just kept referring to Trump's America, and they kept throwing that in there, and I found it very funny how they like to isolate themselves when they talk amongst themselves, but when it's out in public in a vast majority of limelight, that they tend to stay on code. And I was reading I read an article the other day, and they took a poll on the whole Comey versus Trump issue, and the people, between the investigation that they show publicly and Trump coming out and doing what he's doing and, you know, backing up his words, and they're not even finding them at fault. They said they're blaming the media. So, you know, they always seem to stay on code when it's time to stay on code. And I just found that, like, you know, just very, I don't know, it was just crazy to me. Also, I wanted to talk about the apartment racism, how just talking about the same staying on code, how the apartment security, the office, even the sheriff that she went, like the sheriff department that she went to, they all seem to be on the same code. Oh, when she's going to complain, nothing is getting done. They seem to just keep giving her the lip service and the shoo-shoo game. And it's tacky, and it's just surreal that even when we go through this, not even the highest authorities are willing to help us. And, you know, it's frustrating. And in a situation like that, you know, she could, you know, basically have, that's how mental illness come about, you know, because you have nowhere to relieve yourself, nowhere to be protected, and you just lost. And I just felt like that was just crazy to me. And it was her trying to ask for her money back, and they didn't want to give it to her. They were basically telling her she had to pay her terrorism way out. Like, it's just real tacky. And it just goes to show you, like, it's sad, man. It's really sad. And I was talking the part about the lady, she was talking about how in there's 16 states that still have their laws up about the Virginia with their laws up on interracial dating. And that still goes on to this day, because if you guys remember the case, even Paul Mooney had brought that out when he was discussing about racism, how in Louisiana they have laws that'll put you in jail once you go outside, you date outside of your race, you marry outside of your race. Even the 17-year-old standout student from LeVar Allen from Louisiana, he got charged for sex texting a female, a white female who sent him the video first, who started texting with him. Her parents end up telling the authorities, and he's facing jail time for it. So it just goes to show you that this is just a bunch of tacky, a lot of laws that's just put into place to just keep terrorizing black people with no outs left. And that's all I have, so I'll move my life.
Appreciate that, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Happy heard.
I heard two folks. The person that spoke in first, you want to go first?
Greetings, Gus, the host, the callers and listeners. It's Mark in North Carolina. I actually had a racist joke. It was very interesting. I was in the mall yesterday with my wife and my mother-in-law, and they have the vehicles on display inside of different areas of the mall, and they may have like a sweepstakes or something to that effect. And they actually had a camper at this location, and it was a small camper, kind of like a mini camper. It had like a bed inside of it, and it had, you know,
outlets for electrical outlets. They had microwaves, so on and so forth. And so we were just taking a quick look at it, and I noticed that a lot of suspected race soldiers started coming around. And one guy came up in a hover round with like an American flag T-shirt, and he came over and he asked my wife, he said, can he fit in there? And mind you, I'm about 6'3", weigh probably about 240, something to that effect. And she, you know, jokingly responded like, oh, well, yeah, you know, he can fit. Then he said, you sure? And then she said, yeah, we may have to, you know, cut a hole in it or something like that, but he can fit. And then, you know, he switched really quickly, and he told his joke. And his joke was as follows. He said, two potatoes on the side of a road, how do you know which one is the prostitute? And he said, you look for the sticker, and you see the one that says, I, the hoe. And he laughed, and then he said goodbye, and he rolled off in his hover around. And I thought that was fascinating. Usually, from me listening to the show, and, you know, even if I was to ask a white person, for the most part, they would never share a racist joke, but he just did it openly. And I found that really fascinating. And I said, I have to call the cows and share. I didn't get a chance to hear any of the clips, but that's all that I had to share. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Always dig when white folks speak honestly. The other caller who spoke up simultaneously, we heard you as well. If you had commentary, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes,
hello?
Sir. Yes, sir.
Greetings to everybody. Big victim, Birmingham, Alabama. To that first caller, this is in the sunk that came out the sunken place. I like to recommend that you subscribe to Mr. Fox channel and study all the early episodes of the Cows. And all your questions about the show will be answered, because I had a question about you, Gus, because I was wondering why was you staying up in Seattle, Washington? But I didn't want to just ask you. I said, I'm just going to sit back eventually. If I keep on listening, he gonna give me the answer of why he stay in Seattle. And you did. I found the episode. You said it's less confusion. And, you know, living around black people, you know, it's a lot of confusion. And that's what I learned from, you know, by just sitting back, not asking questions, just listening. Because once I started listening to the Cows, I was confused, and I was just coming off of drugs and alcohol. So one, I had my mind cleared, and once I got my system clean. Everything started making I started understanding it, because I just finished listening to the last chapter of Coretta Scott King's autobiography. Her family was really traumatized, and When Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, assassinated, I was pregnant. My mother was pregnant with me. I was born in 1969, February. He died in April 4th, 1968. So I probably was traumatized during her pregnancy when Dr. Martin Luther King had got killed. That's how deep this, you know, when your thinking is, when you start listening to the Cows. And I just want to hit on this real quick. Gus in Area 8, I think you'll be real interested. Somebody stole your banner season 5, House of Cards. Listen to the third episode, Gus, and you'll know what I'm talking about. Thank you for letting me share.
Appreciate that. Other folks who have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up that we've not heard from, do y'all have commentary? Was that someone or they? Oh, I'm hearing speakerphone. No speakerphone, please. If you
know. Ma'am, you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. This is Red from Ohio. Just had a few notes from this week. I went to basically a Juneteenth festival in my state, and one of the main things that I noticed from going to the festival was that there were only white race soldiers or law enforcement employees or law enforcement agents, what have you, working the event. And when I spoke to my sister, she had said that in previous years, the event would be a lot larger than what it was. So they have been slowly, as gentrification has spread, they have slowly taken away more blocks from where the event would be held. That was the first thing. The second thing, to go along with some of the questions, I forgot the male caller, what he calls himself. I remember hearing as far as when white people would be extinct. They had said, at least for this part of the world, it would be within, I know they have, white people have said, as far as the information that they have decided to share with us, it would be within about a half century or a century or so, at least they've said, as far as the quote-unquote coloring or the darkening of the United States. Another thing, I did actually listen to the testimony that Mr. Comey had given to the, I think it was the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I definitely was able to pick out a lot of, from my understanding, him practicing racism, as far as him basically putting himself in a victim status when it came to President Trump, how he was saying that he was too afraid to say anything to President Trump when President Trump was saying that he basically giving him hints as far as not prosecuting different people in his cabinet. He used the word cowardly. And then he also, throughout the whole testimony, basically, he was saying, well, oh, I can't talk about this right now. We'll talk about it in the closed session, which to me made it seem as if, well, I'm only going to talk about it with you, and of course I understand you, mainly white people, you aren't going to share it with everyone else. Two other things. I didn't get to listen to the clips, but just listening to Gus speak, as far as the public amenities, I've noticed that here in Ohio, until we got casinos, our roads were terrible. Lots of different things were horrible. But I've noticed that since we've gotten the casinos, that's when they've started to finally repave some of the roads, especially in the primarily black neighborhoods, which I kind of felt like they did not, of course, the whites in power, they did not want to take the money out of the budget to make, fix the street lights or pave the roads. They decided to basically, for all the black people who would go to the casino, spend their money, they're basically making us black people pay for us to have paved roads, have different public amenities that we've already paid for in taxes. The last thing that I wanted to share was that I did actually get the Man Not book, Dr. Tommy Curry's book, on Thursday, and I have started to read it. And the one thing that I feel like is definitely helping me as far as it being constructive is that it's helping me to better understand the plight of Black males. At least, like I said, I just started reading the book, but it's definitely helping me understand the plight of Black males, at least within this part of the world in the United States. It is actually helping me to be more understanding and to be nicer, not just to the Black males within my immediate family or just my immediate contact, but also just being more willing to be nicer to Black males that I don't even know out in public. And it's also giving me a counter narrative as far as what I have learned or been indoctrinated with when I was in school, because I know that when I graduated high school and then in college, I started to develop this feminist mindset and even wanting to call myself a quote-unquote Black female feminist, which from now my understanding is that there's no such thing. And just to better help me to understand that feminism is more of a white woman activity, where it's just something to help them have more control of black people or non-white people. Thank you for allowing me to share, and that's all I have for at this moment.
Appreciate that, Red. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if we have not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome, awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am in Los Angeles. And I just wanted to start out this week my report by saying that you know, there was an act of white violence that took place in Orlando earlier this week, and initially there were reports that this could have been terrorism. However, the police on the scene indicated that very, very quickly they were able to ascertain that this was, quote, not a situation related to terrorism. And that was my first clue that it was a suspected white supremacist who was behind this shooting that took the lives of, I believe, 6 people in a business complex in Orlando. And what further clued me in to the fact that this was a suspected racist that was behind this shooting was the fact that in the description of the shooter, the news seemed to be giving excuses for the shooter. They reported the shooter as a disgruntled employee, and for me it just seemed like they were basically trying to get the readers or listeners or viewers to empathize with this mass killer. So that's just something that I noted earlier this week, and sure enough, later it did come out that that the shooter in this situation was in fact a suspected white supremacist. So, you know, basically anytime that the news will report excuses for acts of violence and they are very mum about revealing the identity of the perpetrator of that violence, you can be assured that the news is discussing a suspected racist white supremacist. Also, I wanted to touch base on basically what happened with the Bill Maher situation and how there was a tremendous amount of showcasing of victims of racism that took place. I was listening to an earlier episode of Cows, and on one broadcast, a suspected racist gave some information about how victims of racism who are more educated are more susceptible to mind control. And it was just very, very much on display in this situation, because the people who were defending Bill Maher, they are individuals of or they're victims of racism that you would suspect would know better than to defend racists. However, it seems like they're using their authority and their credibility to just do that. And I see this a lot with people who are into the field of study known as African American studies. And it just, to me, it's very evident by now that this particular, this major in particular, I think exists solely for the purposes of confusing victims of racism, conditioning them to accepting racism and finding a place within the system of white supremacy that they find acceptable. And on top of that, it gives them confounding vocabulary to use to basically rationalize coddling or giving excuses for living under the system of racism and doing nothing to remove this system. And I don't know, it's just, it was very disturbing to see that. And I also suspect that in the coming years, they are going to replace African-American studies with some form of what they'll call probably intersectional studies, where the African-American part will play a second role to an emphasis on gender and LGBT style identity. So I just think that this whole, I'm just very, very leery of these African-American studies programs. And another thing is that I think that they're also using some of the testimony of some of our more intelligent victims of racism to find out where are holes in their system of racism, and they want to find out what I guess irks us or what bothers us, and then they can go ahead and amend those areas so that we find our current predicament more acceptable and their role in this predicament more acceptable and excusable. And at this point, I guess I will go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much for listening.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Oh, well, hi, everyone on the line. Hi, Gus. Yeah, no such thing as coincidence, because I was listening to the first segment of Gil Scott-Heron's book. But prior to that, I was listening to Dr. Curry. And I got a little, I mean, it really hit me in my heart. Just, I mean, I understand the effects, or at least I try to understand the effects that and the things that happen to black males. I have a son, and I have many nephews and brothers, and listening to what he had to say about the plight of black males and the lack of consideration just broke my heart. I don't even understand how black males wake up and face the day. It was so, it hit me so hard. And just to hear the young sister talk about it, and having purchased his book and getting a clearer understanding of all of that. And in speaking about feminism, and I've never understood the whole non-white females even playing a part in that feminism thing. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know if we are so, we have gotten ourselves so confused that all we do is we only think like white folk. So we do things like them, and we behave like them, and we act like them. And I'm assuming that's where feminism comes in for a black female, believing that the same role that a white woman plays is the same role that she is supposed to play when it comes to the treatment, consideration, sympathy, empathy of their counterparts, black males. I just, again, it hit me so hard. I cried through the entire program because I could not understand why. Sorry, I don't understand why. Okay, I got you. Come back to me. I got to get myself together. Thanks.
Yes, ma'am. That is the system of racism. White supremacy definitely can take a toll going over the different way that black people have been terrorized. Other folks that are on the line with us who had commentary, folks that we have not heard from, you should go ahead and speak up now.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to you, Gus, the host, and to the callers and listeners. I'm frustrated. What program was she listening to? The lady that was just before me.
I think she said she would take. I know she had said she was going to take a second to kind of compose herself. I think she had said she was listening to Dr. Curry, a program with Dr. Curry, where he might have been talking about his new book, The Man Knot, that just came out. And then I think she also included some of maybe the first study session from Gil Scott-Heron yesterday. She can correct me if I'm in error.
Okay. Thank you. I just kind of missed that first part. So I just, you know, like you say, this system, racism, white, I don't even call it supremacy anymore. I call it white savagery because it is savage and the savages are running it. And it does take its toll because I know the, I was looking at something on a YouTube, the Avise show, and he had did a YouTube video. I had to laugh. It's not funny, but I had to laugh almost like the young lady before really keeps on getting so emotional about it. And he tells the story about Kylie Jenner, who ordered these clothing from this young black lady who's a designer, goes on her site, orders these clothing, and then takes the girl's clothing and sets up her own clothing company. And then put, you know, set up her site and everything. And then selling this girl's site. I mean, they say the pictures of the models on Kylie Jenner's site is just the same as the picture of the models that the that she bought the clothing from, even down to the shoes. And so that was Kylie Jenner. And then her sister Khloé, Kylie Jenner, she did her second. Her sister Khloé did the same thing to another designer first. And then had her attorney send a cease and desist letter to that designer. We basically told her, I guess, the cease and desist, you know, with, you know, I guess, accusing Khloé of stealing her designs. But I understand both designers have basically receipts from where these young ladies, where Khloé and Kylie have bought clothing from them and then have set up their own, you know, and I was sitting up here thinking about it today, and it almost brought me to tears because I'm just like, how do we fight this? How do you steal somebody's clothing designs? I mean, you buy them and then take the clothing design and set up your own, you know, your own website talking about look at my new line here. And you know, it's stolen. I mean, it's the exact same stuff. So I just wanted to put that out there because I know when I think about this stuff, and there are things that I do think about that can get me emotional. I just want to put that, I just, you know, pray for the young lady before us, and I pray for us all, because things are getting worse. We know that the law is not working for us. One young man spoke about the girl at the apartment, and he says, like, she goes to the sheriff. Everybody's on cold. So, you know, only thing I can say is she really probably needs to find an attorney to break the lease. Let me say this real quick, and I get offline. A couple of things about the loving. Actually, I'm just so sick of hearing about this biracial, multiracial stuff. But my only thing was, you're right, they did not mention the age difference. And I remember, I think it was on a previous show that you had or something in your archives, talking about them. And the only thing I could always, the only thing that really stuck out to me was that how does a 17-year-old white boy ends up with an 11-year-old black girl? And I mean, I know the times, but even still. So you know, I just wanted to say that. Oh, wow. Oh, my God, I don't think I had enough of my thoughts. For loving. Oh, the story, the clip about the CRISPR, that to me is, I think they're getting into some dangerous territory right there. That to me is just really something that, like where the man said, you know, you can look at a person that's 150 years old, they look like they're 20, sitting on a what we would call an extinct elephant now, like a mastodon or something like that. And I just listened to that. That is just, to me, that's just really frightening. In terms of the questions that the gentleman asked, and he said something about, I guess, the white people, these are my words, disappear, something about would white supremacy be here. And I, as of now, I'm like, yes, because why? It's the only thing that we know. It would still be here, even if they disappeared. I guess maybe we might want to ask the form, would it be more vicious because they're gone, or would it be people trying to come up with, that you look at this system and say it was just so brutal, so savage, you know, let's see if we can change it. But I think that system would still be here, because as of now, that's all we know, and it is global. It is it's a global system. In terms of how long, you know, I'm not sure. I know people, you know, talk about, you know, out, but I also know too that black people always talking about trying to weed them out and believe that we can, I guess, make them disappear by having children with them, which I don't understand that. But anyway, so I think that was, let me see, I think that's it. Anyway, thanks for taking my call, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Our other caller in Ohio. We have folks who have not shared at all. If you have a hand up and you have not spoken at all, you should go ahead and speak now. Anyone we missed?
Hello.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Greetings to everyone on the line. I will have to go back and listen to the archive of the program. I was not able to catch it from the beginning, but I was working during workplace racism, and if it hadn't occurred anyway, I was wondering if I could share something that happened on the plantation yesterday.
Let's hear it.
I was going through training, and it was like a kind of last day, so the environment was a little lax, like relaxed and stuff. And I don't even really recall how the incident got started, other than the fact that the like classroom portion was being led by a non-white male with a white parent, and he would make statements, and he would lead them with, what I'm about to say, I can say because I'm half white, it's not racist. Or I can say this because I'm half black, it's not racist. That started about an hour-long session of people talking. Yes, thank you. I'm not going into area, but that started about an hour-long session of people talking about racism and stereotypes. But of course, when you don't have that context of the system that we were under, you're just talking, that leaves a lot of room for tackiness. And I saw a great display of tackiness yesterday. Just a couple of instances where he was the non-white male that was, like, I guess, the teacher that day. He was speaking on his family, how his mother being petrified of snakes and how they had to kill one. And a white female that was sitting beside me, she stated, "Oh, did you hang it in the tree?" And he kind of glanced, like, you know, kind of ignored that for a second. And she said it again, but I kind of cut my eye at her. I was looking straight forward, but I cut my eye at her when she said it. And I heard her, like, kind of whisper, like, "Oh, did no one know why I'm asking that?" And so she brings it back up, and she's like, "Well, I asked, did you cut it, did you hang it in a tree after you killed it? Because it's a warning to other snakes, and it can make it rain." I've never heard this before. And I couldn't even form words after that. Another incident was, of course, racist jokes was brought up. I heard one that I had to look up what it was because they said the joke but didn't give the punchline, I guess. One of them was, "What is a Pontiac?" I had to look that up. If you all don't know, I'll go ahead and give the punchline. The one I found, at least, it was, "Poor old nigger thinks it's a Cadillac." It was another one, but I don't recall it this exact time that it was. Then, of course, another white female brings up, "Well, someone actually accused me of being racist before," and she goes into this highly, I believe, edited story of how a black female comes in and accuses her of thinking that she stole the clothes that she was trying to buy, even though she had a receipt. She accuses her of trying to say that the white woman thought she was stealing because she was black and how it made her cry, and she was really upset. She hadn't ever had that happen to her before. And it was just an extremely tacky experience. It was definitely interesting. And the last thing I wanted to say about that is someone has asked before why it's important to note that non-white person has a white parent. And I have been in this classroom for about 5 weeks in this training session, and I always suspected that one of the other people in there had a white parent. Well, that was confirmed yesterday because the guy who was, like, reading the class kept talking about he had a white parent, and the other non-white male who I assumed had a white parent, but I never asked, and whatever, he goes, "Oh, I can relate." So, he, throughout this whole entire tacky incident, things that he was starting to say explained a lot of his behaviors, such as, like, how he was, when the whole racist joke was brought up, he said, "Well, I know you haven't been around my uncle, then you haven't heard all of them, you haven't been around my uncle." And it's just the things that they were saying just completely validated in my mind that it's important to know that a non-white person has, like, it's important if you know that a non-white person has a white parent, because the amount of just abuse that they must experience on an everyday basis, and the fact that they can't, like, just to try to imagine, like, they can't make sense of it because it's coming from people that they're told are supposed to love them and their family, and they're supposed to look out for them, protect them, keep them safe, and teach them how to exist in this world. But the amount of abuse that they have to go through, it just, the effects of it, I don't think, unless you are that person, and even if you are that person with a non-white parent, a non-white person, I don't think you really can understand. So, yeah. Wanted to share that. I will definitely go back and listen to the archives. Thank you.
How wacky. I think that question was asked on a compensatory call in last year, if memory serves. I think good old Puff, she asked that question, why is it significant that a non-white person has a white parent, which I have concluded it is significant. They're still a victim, but that's just can be pertinent information to help you get a better understanding of why things are happening. But wow, at the training session, no less. Fascinating. Workplace racism every Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If folks have commentary they want to share on workplace racism every Thursday. But wow, that is fascinating. I would have been jotting down notes feverishly. And at a training, no less. Wow. Whew. Quite a bit. Other folks that...
And then you hate it when we say we're done and then we come back. I know, I wish I could have been able to record or write down or anything while it was happening, but we were not allowed telephones, like any cell phones, and we don't have paper, no pen, just computer. So I don't have all the details. I wish I did. Oh, my goodness. I would have played it for y'all, but yeah, sorry.
Wow. Workplace racism, got to be vigilant. It seems like there will probably be more environments like that where either they do not allow you to have a phone or don't allow you to write things down. So it might be a quality investment for the other little gadgets that they're coming out with where you can have like a MP3 recorder or a video recorder on a pen or your glasses or earrings or, you know, watch. Lots of, you know, little innocuous things that you could easily have with you in those sort of environments, and you would still be able to record information so you can have an accurate log of whatever happened, racist jokes, all of it. Folks, if there are any folks that we've missed completely, if there's anybody we missed who has a hand up that we have not heard from at all, because we only have about 40 minutes left. The sun is still bright out here on the West Coast. It's only about 8:20 p.m., so it's bright and lovely. My favorite time of the year, June in Seattle, where the sun is out until about 10 p.m. But for that throws me off in terms of the time, because I'm used to it being dark now. So we only have 40 minutes left, so if you have commentary, you should get your hand up now. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Any folks who have a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Do we get everybody? We didn't miss anybody? Anybody has a hand up that has not spoken at all? Grant, I will assume that we got everyone so far. Any of the folks who are with us have additional commentary that they wanted to make sure they include?
Can I be heard?
Let's see. I heard two people. We'll get Ken Steele second. Who is the other caller? I just heard two people, I thought. Maybe I didn't. Could be going bonkers. Was Mr. Steele one of the people who spoke?
Yeah, that was definitely me.
Proceed.
Awesome. I just wanted to say that one thing that I've noticed that's being pushed by the suspected racist this week is a character out of California named Kamala Harris. She's a suspected, or she's a victim of racism that is being showcased currently in her role as a senator. And I believe she was recently showcased on the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing during the Comey investigation. They gave her a few questions to ask the former FBI director.
I just wanted to say that Kamala Harris, for Victims of Racism, I just want to let everybody know that she's being talked about as a potential candidate for the presidency. And she would be another, I guess, lighter-skinned, Ivy League-educated victim of racism that is being showcased, and I think is explicitly for the purposes of attracting non-white voters. Kamala Harris, she is currently in a tragic arrangement. Her husband is a suspected white supremacist named Douglas Emhoff, and so I believe that she kept the last name Harris so that she appears to be, what some of her supporters are calling, quote-unquote, the real deal. So, her husband's last name is Emhoff. His name is Douglas Emhoff. She was also a prosecuting attorney during her time here in California, and she was instrumental in placing a number of victims of racism in greater confinement. So, Kamala Harris, a victim of racism, currently being showcased by the Democratic Party to be a potential candidate for the office of the presidency. Another one of these light-skinned Democrats is a person named Cory Booker, who is also in the Senate seat, or is in the Senate out of New Jersey. And just before I get offline, it should be noted that Donald Trump and the Kushner family have personally donated money to Cory Booker's campaign to the tune of, I believe, $42,000 in his most recent senatorial run. And Donald Trump himself sent out a tweet regarding Cory Booker that he knows more about Cory Booker than Cory Booker knows about himself. So beware of some of these light-skinned Democrats that are being showcased by the Democratic Party and that are being positioned as potential candidates for higher political office, including President of the United States. So thank you so much, and I will mute my line at this time.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Red again. Just on the note of Kamala Harris, I think if I'm not mistaken, because I did listen to Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, I think she did actually mention Kamala Harris, but definitely you can correct me if I'm wrong. Another thing that I forgot to mention, just referring back to Dr. Tommy Curry's book, I had looked up the picture of the young black male on the book because the picture was familiar to me, but it was a little bit, I was a little bit confused about the full history. But the picture on the book is George Feeney Jr. And when I was looking up different stories about him on YouTube, just to get a better understanding of his history, because I do remember he was one of the youngest people who was executed, at least in Texas or within the United States. One of the interviews that I found was it was a brief interview that CNN conducted, and they interviewed his sister and also the relatives of his quote unquote victims. And one of the main things that stuck out to me, which just definitely made me feel like the relatives of his quote-unquote victims were definitely racist. I guess I could still say that they were suspected racist. They were saying that, and for anyone who doesn't know his victims, they said that Mr. Steeney, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing his last name right, they said that he killed
two young white women, or two young white girls, drug their bodies and their bikes into a field after he savagely beat them to death. He was only 14 years old, and he was put to death by a Texas court. Well, when they had some of the relatives of the young white girls interviewed, the relative said, well, their family must also admit to their guilt, even though his conviction was later overturned after, of course, they had put him to death, because they, if I'm not mistaken, they put him to death the same year that they convicted him. They said, his family must also know that he did this horrible crime, because they haven't even put up a headstone or went to go visit the grave once he was put to death. But then they also, after these suspected racists said this thing, his sister also commented, because she was there the same day that they had saw the two white girls. And she had said, well, the reason why we didn't put up a headstone was because, you know, people would have dug up his body and thrown him, I think she said, maybe like in a river or what have you. So I definitely thought that it was definitely very reminiscent of, I think the book was Blood at the Root. You could definitely correct me if I'm wrong, where they actually used black people's headstones for, like sidewalks or like for stoops for other white people's homes after they took over this, after white people took over the city. So it definitely lets you understand, it definitely helped for me to better understand the fact that, like what was said in Medical Apartheid, and I definitely appreciate all the book studies and that are conducted on the show, that white people, they just don't terrorize you from birth to death. It's also after death. I just wanted to mention that. Thank you for allowing me to share again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Blood at the Root that mentioned whites, race soldiers in Forsyth County, Georgia, using black people's headstones as sidewalks to decorate their houses. But George Stinney was in South Carolina. Ben Tillman, Dylan Roof, he was executed in 1944. And I just remember that because they did a lot of, they had a lot of anniversaries and ceremonies around the 70-year anniversary of his execution, which was in 2014. And they interviewed some of the quote-unquote white victims, family members, relatives, and some of George Stinney, the 14-year-old who was lethally sentenced for the supposed crime. They interviewed both sets. And I remember some of the white family members in 2014 saying, oh yeah, he did it. You know, no doubt in my mind, niggas, you know, niggas and flies always in something. That's basically the attitude that they had 70 years on. Like, I think I probably played some of that on the program. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to make sure they get in.
Can I be heard?
Let's get I think we have Princess with us. We hadn't heard from her at all, and then we'll get the other folks also. Princess, did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I apologize for the noise, because I am en route to home, because I'm just now getting off work. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to state real quick, because I'm calling from Florida. Most of you may know that they've recently remembered the anniversary of this Pulse nightclub shooting. It's been a big deal down here as far as the media coverage. And I just noted the difference from that versus the Charleston massacre, how it was on, you might as well say basically eclipsed as far as coverage and remembrance of the victims and stuff like that. So I purposely really didn't share or want to talk about the Pulse nightclub shooting because just out of respect for the victims that continue to be casualties in this ongoing conflict globally. But I also, if it would be okay with Gus, I just wanted to share a bit of a spoiler alert in regards to my workplace situation. Would that be okay?
Oh, let's hear it.
Okay. Yesterday I was off. In the morning I received a call from corporate. The investigators that I had been speaking to within the last week, who I had requested to speak to someone else that I was dealing with in New Orleans when I was having the issues there. I guess because of her workload or, you know, she wasn't able to personally take on the case, so he reiterated that he would be assisting me. So I was writing down a note. To make a long story short, he stated, I reiterated the Fifth and the 14th Amendment to him. Throughout the conversation, it just seemed like he was trying to play devil's advocate, but I wasn't even trying to go there. I have my documentation, my facts, and everything, and I just let him know, look, you know, I'm not going to be doing your work. Like Mr. Fuller had basically told me, I should be doing very little talking at this point. So I wasn't going to put all my cards on the table as to the evidence that I have as to what took place, as to why I was abruptly moved from this store to where I'm at now. And so he basically, after getting some more information from me, it was about an hour-long interview, he had indicated that someone will be coming down to interview me because he said the areas of concern that he has, and roughly stating that he is concerned at the fact that this district manager asked me, was I the one that contacted corporate? And he was concerned at the fact that I was moved and I wasn't given a permanent schedule. They were trying to make it seem like I was hired as a floater when I never was. And, you know, that they was trying to basically make it seem like it was something in the paperwork that got mixed up or there was some misunderstanding. He said those were areas of high concern, and he stated that, you know, that he knows that I'm aware of our policy. So from the tone of his voice, as far as what we had discussed, that is what they're going to hone in on, because we, you know, they have an open door policy. And like I told him, you know, most companies that have, you know, over a certain amount of employees, they have to abide by certain laws. So, I am supposed to be meeting with somebody from corporate. I don't know when, so I've just been compiling all of my documentation and writing up everything. I have photos of different things from certain days, so I'll be getting copies of that to hand over to them if need be, depending, you know, on how things go. And I will just be keeping everything in my purse. So that way, whoever comes in, I already have it in, you know, ready. So I'm not caught off guard or anything. And I've just been looking over the policy and procedures, you know, things that I would want to be asking them and compiling some questions that I have for them.
Spectacular. That is always music to my ears when I hear a black person saying they are reviewing their policy and procedure, not reading it for the first time, not overwhelmed by it, not confused, not I can't find it. I am reviewing my policy and procedure to help construct questions to ask. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. Let us know how it goes, what questions you come up with, and you know what the resolution. That's a great tip for Mr. Fuller as well, because that's what you want to strive for, efficiency with your words, so that you are not just talking and talking and talking and talking, where you can, you know, in very short order, You don't have buckets of words. You just need like a saucer. You got your few words and we are all good for the day. My questions, this is what it is and how are we going to resolve the issue? Another question. Appreciate that, Princess. I know we heard, I had two people who spoke up before Princess spoke. I think one was a female, one was a male. The female caller that spoke up just before Princess, we heard from Princess. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yeah, I wanted to apologize for breaking down like that. I didn't, that was so not cool of me, but, you know, I apologize. But I was listening to Dr. Tommy Curry's 8th visit to the Cal, and that was on the 16th, I believe, of September. And, you know, just trying to figure out this whole mental health thing, and I don't understand how we can have any sort of mental health. I remember when Dr. Welzing's sister was on, and she spoke about this book, Love Yourself, and Let the Other Person Have It Your Way. I mean, I got the book, I read the book, and it was somewhat helpful, but, you know, not completely, because this is a white person giving information, not to say that they don't have information, because they do. But a lot of it centered on, like, not just loving yourself, but, like, forgiving. And I'm having a difficult time with that when I'm listening to Dr. Curry and hearing all of this stuff that's happening and continues to happen to us as a people, especially to Black males, and then having a book to love yourself and to try to gain some sort of mental health. And it talks about forgiving. And I don't know where I stand on that whole forgiveness thing. And, you know, you learn about, you know, being self-aware. You try to get some awareness and consciousness. And then, you know, you hear, get books and they talk about your ego. And then you're looking at, but they want you to look at the ego of the person who is causing your oppression. And even in that, you need to forgive, because it's not the person, it's the ego. So how do you line that up with your Black self and trying to gain your sense of sanity and still try to figure out how to solve the problem of your abuse? I get confused with the whole loving yourself, mental health, trying to forgive. I don't know if that's even a possibility, really. And the question about whether or not there'll be supremacy if there were no white people, I believe there will be. It's all over, it's global. So that, I mean, there's so many things that have to change before that can, before that would change. I mean, just looking at South Korea, the biggest plastic surgery facility in the world. And when you speak to different Asians, they talk about what their perception of beauty is, and it's white. And they change their features to look more white because they feel that they're going to gain a better position. So, yeah, if they're not here, it's still in, we're still infected by it. So what do you do to make it stop? Do you, because there's so much confusion, so much division, and I know I'm all over the place with this, but they've caused so much division with non-white people. I mean, for me, there's only two people on the planet, although Mr. Fuller says there's three, non-white people, white people, and white supremacists. I personally think there's only two, white and Black. But they've got us so confused and so separated that Asian people think they're not Black, but they are. But, all right. Yeah, I'm rambling. So, all right, I'm good. I'm good. Hopefully I'll get my thoughts together, and next time I'll be a little more concise and a little more efficient. But thanks for listening.
Yes, ma'am. We are all still learning. The male who spoke up simultaneously, did you have commentary you were going to add as well? Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. And maybe I can get your thoughts or reactions, just for some kind of confirmation. But I had realized, because I was hanging around white people so much and so involved, that I began to become what they would say asexual. I began to believe wholeheartedly in things like abortion, and, you know, I would talk about, you know, even to the point of receiving a vasectomy. And I was taking it out on my own biology. My health started to dwindle. I was losing weight. You know, I was like turning green. My pigment was changing, you know, it was just unhealthy. Happy to say now, you know, I'm with a black woman, have been for a while. But it really affected me in my thinking to a point where I just did not realize it. I know you speak of Dr. Francis Quest Wilson quite a bit, and I was just wanting to see if you had any thoughts or reaction as to why I may have been feeling that way. And I will mute my phone.
I would have to hear more detail, but if I was just going to give a quick thought, I know Mr. Fuller, when he spoke about the epitome of white supremacy, he said he would pick someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, that is the point of racism. White supremacy is to totally, to not just kill you, call you nigger a few times, but to totally destroy you and to completely destroy your sexuality as well. He talked about that with Jeffrey Dahmer, and he even related that to the history of castrating, genital mutilation against black males. This George Denny, lots of examples, Emmett Till, lots of examples of this sort of behavior being carried out. The case that was mentioned earlier about the texting incident where the black male ended up being prosecuted, where this happens pretty consistently to totally, Dr. Welsing talked about that as well, to totally destroy the sexuality, particularly of black males. So that's what it sounds like it could be to me. Obviously, I would need more detail. That's just given a brief opinion. But, you know, I'm sure with some, even probably just you reflecting on it yourself, I'm sure you could take some time. That's the sort of thing why I encourage journaling, where you can kind of reflect. You can go over a lot of those details and really think about it, because you can probably give a better analysis, because you have more of the details than anybody else here. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have comments here, we have less than 15 minutes left in the broadcast, so you should speak up if you think you have commentary.
Have you heard?
Oh,
ladies first, go ahead.
Right on.
Okay. All right, thank you. I'll make this real quick. Just, you know, with a young man before me, that was talked about, you know, hanging out with white people, and you know, basically, it almost, you know, I remember one time I called your show, and you had Dr. Rice Dion on, and I was asking him something about, like, you know, at this time, you know, when they would have the protests for the police shooting black people, like, say, like Mike Brown, and my question was wondering what it is about, you have these protests, and it's like white people run out to be a part of this, and he said something about parasitic vampires. I remember he told me, he said, look up parasitic vampires. So just listening to this gentleman right before me, and it just, like you say, it's like fucking your life out of you. But this is what I wanted to say, this just for what he was saying, and it made me think of something. And I guess maybe this is something that I don't know if you may notice it or hear people talk about it. You might want to say, make a comment. I don't know. It's just like a couple of weeks ago, I was just thinking about, you know, just life and about when you, like, we work with white people or around white people. And it just seemed that it is something about white people that in, and this is just a general statement, in black people, it seems to disconnect our, like, warning signals. And it made me think of you. I'm older than you are, and so you may not know this, but there used to be a show on TV called Lost in Space. And it was about this family. They were supposed to be lost in space.
Yeah, Mom said she was going to sit aside from.
People are talking on the background. Say again if you're... No, there's noise. Use your mute button. Much obliged. My apologies.
Okay, thank you. So, and on this show, you like I said, it's a family, and they were lost in space. And so they was it was a, like a mother and a father, and you had a daughter and a son, and there was a professor. I think it was a couple other people with them. But they had this robot. And anytime they were, like, out on this planet and say danger come, the robot would, like, danger, danger, warning, warning, danger, danger. And then if it was really dangerous, the robot would light up, the head would light up, and just start moving its arm. Danger, danger, you know, warning, warning, danger. And I was just thinking, I said, because it seems like to me that we are created with a warning guide, if you will. And I was just thinking, I said, it's something about white people, that black people, when we get around them or they come around us, it almost like that is just this, it's like it's disarmed. And unfortunately, it can lead to tragic results. Even to something like what this gentleman was just talking about, that being around them, I become asexual. I, you know, got a vasectomy. I don't know if he said that, but I mean, it's almost to a point of getting a vasectomy. And just crazy, he even said that, you know, I start losing weight, my skin starts turning green. I mean, that's almost like a slow, what you say, the parasitic vampire death. And I mean, I don't know if anybody else has experienced that. So I'm just kind of like throw that out, because since he said that, and it just made me think of that. And it just, like I say, it's just like that warning died in us. If they come around us or we come around, and I know that is all a part of this savvy system that we have that we've been existing in, you know, for hundreds of years, you know. And I just wanted to put that out there to see if anybody have any comment, or does it make sense? Does it sound like that? Or it just maybe could be me. But anyway, I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate that. Retired firefighter, did you have commentary you were going to add, sir?
Yes, sir. I was going to comment on the caller who asked the question about quote unquote white people no longer existing, and the question he was asking if there will still be something that is called white supremacy. This victim asked this question on Mr. Fuller's program Wednesday, and basically, if I can attempt to give a logical answer, I'm going to attempt to. First of all, white people who call themselves white is not a biological construct, so I don't know what that, I don't know exactly what that means from the standpoint of white people eliminating themselves. I don't know what that means biological construct. I know what it means for people to die off or for whatever reasons or become extinct. That is possible, but in terms of something that is not a biological construct, which is what people call themselves white, it's a political one. I hope I'm making some sense on what I'm saying. It just doesn't make any sense. The only thing I do know is theoretically, if there is such thing as he's suggesting, there would probably not be something called white supremacy, but it definitely would be something that probably have to be named mass confusion out of the people, the non-white, quote unquote, people who are left on planet Earth until we can possibly fix our psychological, mental, and physical situations that was attributed to the global system of racism and white supremacy. It would be mass confusion in that process if they just stopped operating the machinery, put it that way. It'd be very few medical help that would be going on, because there's not enough non-white people who are skilled in that environment versus so many sick people, and so on and so forth down the road. The trains will stop, you know, for the most part, because not that many of us shipping and whatever that takes place transportation-wise in order to bring about food and you know, things that are vital to living. Matter of fact, we would be in dire jeopardy if something like that actually did take place. But I would put caution originally on what I stated by to remind this person who I assume is a non-white victim of racism, white supremacy, that racism or white people is a political construct, not a biological one. So I don't know what that means for quote unquote white people to go extinct biologically. I don't know what that means. Hopefully I'm making sense. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. We have about 5 minutes left. Folks have any final comments they want to get in? Last few moments. You should take advantage. Go ahead and speak now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is The Voice again. I wanted to touch on what Ken Steele was saying about Kamala Harris. And it's funny that he brought that up because when I was at work earlier today, I got a call from a local politician that I have been running with for like a year and a half now. And she called me up and asked me if I wanted to get the seat of the Jamaican Democratic Caucus here in Florida. So I told her, you know, I'll take it. So I'm supposed to be aligned up to get that seat. And she said that she was going to align me up to meet Ms. Kamala Harris, as well as another representative named Andrew Gillum, who is a phenomenal black mayor of Tallahassee who's running against Rick Scott for the governor's seat. So there's a lot of things that's been aligned down here, and I feel pretty good about it. I wanted to talk about, I read an article about the non-black Hispanic male that got killed by the suspected white supremacist and his wife, Johnny Hernandez. There was an article that stated the LULAC, which is the Hispanic version of the NAACP. And they, in the article, at the end of the article, they end up writing, saying that the killing of Johnny Hernandez being choked out by this white supremacist was a lynching, and they were calling for the actions of black people to join forces with them. And I found them using the word lynching to be very odd and quite disrespectful in a way, if you ask me. But that's pretty much what I wanted to say. And I'll be Mala.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I just wanted to follow up with the statements that I was making last week regarding gun ownership and these gun licenses that they are encouraging victims of racism to purchase. There was a victim of racism that was recently killed. When defending his home against an attacker with a gun. What had happened was this took place in Ohio, and the victim's name was Brendan Hester. Apparently, somebody came and was attacking his family, and then he had the perpetrator held at gunpoint, and they were waiting for the police to show up. The police showed up and then shot Brendan Hester. So even in your home with a personal defense weapon, PDW, as they're referred to, you can, you as a victim of racism are exposing yourself to a tremendous amount of danger and trouble when you have a gun in your hands in this system of racism, white supremacy. Unless if you are willing to shoot it out with the authority figures and fight to the death, presenting yourself with a firearm can make you eligible for immediate termination or immediate submittance to greater confinement. So be very careful when it comes to these firearms. Be very careful when it comes to registering for these gun permits. You are putting yourself on a list that says that you own firearms. So I strongly caution against letting suspected racists know that you are armed and that you are carrying. This is counter to your safety. So please be very careful around guns. Thank you.
The same, I guess the same suggestion or the same thing that I say when people talk about it being dangerous to address racism, white supremacy. Race soldiers kill a lot of black people who have nothing to say about racism. I think the same would apply to gun ownership. They certainly kill, terrorize, and place in greater confinement a huge number of black people who are unarmed. But certainly, point well taken about be cautious, be codified, be very serious if you're going to own firearms, because a lot of times racists can make a lot more trouble for us with their weapons, their guns. With that, that is our 3 hours. We will be here. We got lots of promotions for workplace racism throughout the course of the broadcast today. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here for that. I think this week will be the third Sunday. Let me look at the calendar and double check it. Yep. So third Sunday will be not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, third Sunday. So that'll be our global Sunday talk on racism. They just had the big election in England. Theresa May won, but she took a beating in the election. Her party lost a lot of political power. I think Stacey was even talking about she didn't vote for Theresa May on workplace racism a couple days ago. We'll review that as well as a lot of other things that have taken place globally. That'll be a week from tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. You can check the Black Talk Radio Network page as well as the Facebook group for our upcoming broadcasts. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in. I hope the compensatory call-in was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. We will be back soon. If you have a question, if you are trying to find something in the archives, someone just emailed about previous times we talked about George Stinney on the cows. If you're looking for something in the archives and can't find it, you can drop an email. If you have a guest suggestion or idea for a broadcast, gripe, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. As I've stated consistently, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it is great. It was beautiful. It wasn't even super warm today, but it was still sunny. Wonderful. I sat outside quite a bit earlier in the day. Even if you're doing all that, you still want to remain codified. Sobriety would be best. You do not want to be out getting your sunshine on and then be confronted with a race soldier, badge or no, and have to use words, think correctly, make great decisions to protect, save your life, or to stay out of greater confinement. You don't want to have to do that after you've had a little bit to drink or whatever else, any other narcotics. That is not going to help your situation. War is being waged against us. That should be reflected in our behavior at all times. And I think there is a sizable amount of evidence that non-white people, black people in particular, being under the influence of all of these substances has not helped us replace white supremacy with justice. If anything, it seems to make white people better able to dominate and terrorize us. So keep that in mind, and maybe we could save our nickels as well. Sobriety would be best. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed. I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.